Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
And welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here as always to talk about stuff. Sorry for the last week that was off. Really, it was just schedules not working out.
Yeah, and there wasn't a huge amount to talk about for the podcast, so I felt like we didn't need to push it.
No, we had a couple like things, but they weren't necessarily timely things. So today on the show, and this might get split into a two-part episode, we'll just record bumpers for it, and that's what'll happen. But we've got a lot to talk about, just sort of personal stuff. I've got, like, my continued adventures with Dragon Ball Z and things like that, which, if you're totally uninterested in that show, I guess you're fast-forwarding those parts of the show. But, you know, whatever. If you're on the Digimon Persona train, Doctor Who train with us, you probably like Dragon Ball Z.
You should.
It's a really good show. Anyway, we got that. I've got some games I played. Sean's got some games he played. I think our big review this week is we're going to review Inside, which I talked about. And now Sean has played, and we really can't talk about it without spoilers, so I'm glad we can finally talk about it.
It's like a three-hour long game, so there's not a lot of room to talk around the stuff that happens in it.
Yeah, and then our main topic is going to be Star Trek turns 50 this year.
Yeah.
It's the 50th anniversary of the original TV series, 1966, is when that premiered. We played the original theme song at the top of this show.
The beautiful theme.
It's actually not the original. That's the second season theme song. The first season did not have the singer. And was weaker for it.
Yeah.
Yes. The singer in the background is great.
Yeah. You need that crazy like space wailing. The Enterprise flying through the stars.
Absolutely. So we're going to talk about Star Trek. You know, and really the excuse is that Star Trek Beyond is coming out. That's a movie we are definitely looking forward to.
Yeah. Definitely going to see that.
Especially now that it's gotten really good reviews. And that's I was waiting for that because the trailers were like, I have no idea.
Yeah, because it was something where it was weird where I felt pretty confident about it before any of the trailers dropped, because I liked the first two movies. I really love Simon Pegg and him doing the script and all that stuff. It's like, okay, that sounds like that's going to be really good. And then each successive trailer actually like diminished my faith that the movie was going to be good. I was going to see it no matter what, obviously. But it was like, oh no, is this movie actually going to be bad? That would really suck.
Yeah. Anyway, but sounds like it's good. We're excited to talk about that. And we're just going to do a kind of retrospective. I have a list where I ranked the movies, but we're also going to talk about the show, because that's...
because that's what Star Trek is it's a goddamn TV show.
It is, and it's a weird thing where, because we only have movies right now, although that will be changing soon, thankfully, we kind of have to talk about movies as a retrospective thing, and where Star Trek Beyond fits in the movies. But Star Trek as an entity, to us and to a lot of people, is a TV series.
Yeah, I mean, that's where it came from, that's what it's like designed to be, and it's funny that the movie side of it has, it like recent years become like the public facing side of Star Trek, but it is fundamentally a TV show.
And we are getting a new TV show next year. I mean, we've got Brian Fuller's Star Trek, which I am so happy I can say those words. Mm-hmm. We got next year Brian Fuller's Star Trek and Brian Fuller's Neil Gaiman's American Gods.
Yeah,
co-starring Gillian Anderson.
Perfect.
That's going to be a good show.
Yeah.
I think those are both going to be really good shows.
Very good book.
Anyway, so that's exciting. And so that'll be our big topic. Let's go ahead and jump into some stuff. Sean?
Yeah.
You know what? I'm sorry. I'm delaying you for just a second.
That's okay.
Because I wanted to mention I had some stuff on the website.
All right.
I actually finally started writing again.
Oh,
and it
wow.
It felt good.
Yeah.
It felt really good. I published a top 10 list. This month is the Criterion Collection sale at Barnes & Noble. Which basically is, if you collect Criterion DVDs, it's one of the 2 months of the year where you buy Criterion stuff. Because they're 50% off. Like, unless it's something I really love that is in one of those off months, I will wait for, basically, it's July and November. Barnes & Noble does this. And then there's flash sales in September and I believe April on the Criterion website. So those are the big days when you buy their discs. So they're 50% off. I've already bought a bunch in this sale and watched a couple, so very exciting. And I decided, I was like, you know what? I want to... Everybody on Earth does this. A big Criterion thing. If you do your like top 10 Criterion discs, that's a big thing they do on their site and stuff. I'm like, I should do that. I have a lot of these. Mm-hmm. I think at my current count, I have 60-something. So... That's less than 10% of the collection. They're in the 800s right now on their spines.
Jesus Christ.
And that actually does not count. The Zatoichi movies were all one spine number because I guess they didn't want to do 26 spines at once.
Yeah, that is a lot more than one movie. I can confirm. I've seen them.
So the Zatoichi, so if you do like they're on spine 830-something plus 26 Zatoichi movies. Anyway, so I did that. That's on the site. It's part of a new column I might publish semi-regularly with top 10 lists and stuff.
Going back to your roots.
Going back to my roots, just because I got stuff to do with that, and it's there. Here's the real secret. They're easy to write.
Yeah.
And they're fast.
It's just a very effective way to format an article to write.
And my goal with this is not to do the clickbait stuff, like top 10 times Kirk was sexy in Star Trek 09.
Top 10 weird Pokemon Go pictures.
No. I have a lot of ideas, and I think they're a little more in-depth. And some of them I might just do on the podcast. Like, I don't think I'm going to write this Star Trek one up, although I might. Might not. And then some I think are going to be fun, like with my Dragon Ball Z rewatching project. One of the things I've been doing as I'm watching is I'm watching all the movies where they originally came out. And I've been keeping a list where I rank them relative to each other as I go. So when I'm done, I have them, the 13, ranked for myself.
Okay,
and it's actually really surprising because there are movies I thought I was going to hate that are really high, and movies I thought I liked that I don't anymore.
I'm going to be really surprised when that list comes out and Bio Broly is at the top.
It could
just
be.
Just chilling out.
Dude,
what's up, motherfucker?
I watched the 7th movie today. That's Super Android 13.
Yeah?
And I never liked that one before. I just remembered not liking it. And I went, like, this one's really good.
I remember that one being okay. Like, that's in my, like, the big bucket of, like, the Dragon Ball Z movies. It's like, it's not terrible. It's not Bio Broly, but it's not amazing either.
And it's about middle on the list for me right now. But, like, what I realized, that movie has probably the thinnest plot of any DBZ movie, and that's saying something. But what they lack for in plot, like, the fight choreography and animation and the way they use the characters in that one is supremely badass.
Yeah.
And that's about all you can really ask of a Dragon Ball movie, so...
Although the Super Android 13 is the one in my memory that most represents one of my biggest issues with the post-Super Saiyan Dragon Ball Z movies, which is they just wait till the end of the movie to turn Super Saiyan.
It's about halfway
through. It drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Because it's like, why? Why? Like, I understand why. But, like, for them, like, making the movie in terms of them pacing the fight scenes, but within, like, the logic of the series... It drives me fucking insane. The worst one is actually the first Cooler movie in that regard. Because and that's one where you just kind of have to ignore that Goku should just be able to go Super Saiyan and pretend that he can't go Super Saiyan until the end of the movie.
It's a weird thing where both Cooler movies have that problem in spades. This one actually is better about it. It's maybe 20 minutes of the fight, so it's a good half the movie they're Super Saiyan. I had remembered it being worse too.
But it's just like, I think it's just that because you're waiting for Goku, Trunks and Vegeta all go Super Saiyan at the same time. So it's like they're cutting between them and you're just waiting like, why are you... You're getting your asses kicked. What do you do, you fucking idiot?
Although when they do it, it's fucking awesome.
It's cool.
They all go at once and then Vegeta and Trunks both just tear their androids apart.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. Anyway, I'll talk about Dragon Ball in a little bit. So that's on the site. And then I also wound up watching... a movie I had missed in theaters earlier this year because I swear to God it was in Denver for like a day and a half. And that was the new Terrence Malick film, Night of Cups, which will not be of interest to most people. This is, I mean, Terrence Malick has a limited appeal to a lot of people to begin with. He's a very art house director. He's gotten more art house as the years have gone along. Night of Cups is an experimental film. It's got Christian Bale and Natalie Portman and Cate Blanchett and a bunch of people like in voice cameos who probably shot more for the movie but are like big stars.
Right.
Like Nick Offerman from Parks and Rec has this...
That's weird. That's a weird pull for a fucking Malick movie.
Yeah, and clearly he shot more than he did, but there's a line you hear in the background where he is saying, and I could tell it's him, he's saying something about, like, I feel like an 11-year-old kid playing Call of Duty. And then he gives this speech about it. It's really weird. Anyway, the Blu-ray came out. Finally got to see that movie. And I wound up just watching it. And I was like, I kind of want to write something about that. And first I just started doing some notes, which is what I often do. I start to write something. And I'm like, well, this is already in the form of an essay. Intro, spot check things. There we go. And okay. So I had fun with that. It's on the site if you're interested. I really liked it. I haven't gotten to sit down and like write a film-centric essay in a while. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. And really, I think the last movie I wrote about at length was Batman v Superman.
Right, yeah.
This was better.
I mean, it has to be, right? It has to be.
Yeah. I feel bad for all the press people getting like the Blu-rays of the Ultimate Edition of that movie.
They have to watch
the 3-hour version of it. Yeah. If 2.5 wasn't bad enough. Anyway, so that's all on the site. I'll have more stuff like that, trying to get some more stuff published, because I feel better when I write.
I don't know. Writing is, it is a cathartic exercise.
Absolutely.
For sure.
All right, Sean, you finished Dishonored, you said.
Yeah, so last time we did the podcast, which was 2 weeks ago, I was a handful of missions. I think I was 3 missions into it at that point, so I was still like in the first third of the game. Now I've beaten it, and then I've also played through the DLC, which is on... although there's one piece of DLC that I have not done, the Dunwall City Trials, which just didn't really appeal to me. But there are 2 pieces of story DLC that when you put them together, and they are basically put together, it's just like one thing split in half. It is basically Dishonored 1.5, so it's really like it's a pretty significant chunk of content if you get the Definitive Edition thing. And so yeah, I've played it all, and I beat it like a week ago, so like I'm kind of having to charge up my memory a bit. But my overall impressions are that I really, really like it. I think it's a very strong game. And it's the first game of this type in that sort of like Deus Ex lineage that I've really enjoyed, that I've tried to get into these kinds of games time and time again, and I've never really sort of been compelled by them. I tried to go back and play the original Deus Ex, which is a game that has not aged very well. And then when Deus Ex Human Revolution came out, I tried to play that and couldn't get into that either. And this is the first one that I think, largely because it's the stealth element of the gameplay, I think it's just really well executed, and the powers are a lot of fun to use, that it is just a fun game to play, on top of it having the... You can play through the levels in a bunch of different ways, and you can go through it without killing people, or you can just slaughter everyone in your path, and all that kind of stuff. And so I've had a really good time with it. And basically, the way I did play through the game was going through completely non-lethally, which is sort of... And that's where like my kind of main criticism of the game also comes in, is that I think the way they handle the split between the lethal style playthrough, where I replayed a couple of the missions just to see what it was like to just slaughter everyone and actually engage with the combat mechanics, because I had beaten the entire game without killing anyone intentionally. Like I didn't get the like trophy or whatever for like a pure pacifist playthrough, because at some point, someone died. Someone fucking tripped and fell down some stairs that had nothing to do with me in the level, but that counted as a death, and so I didn't get the fucking trophy, which is a big pain in the ass. But the split between being completely non-lethal and being completely lethal, in terms of the narrative side of it, I don't think is handled very well, in the sense that the story justification for what you are doing is that you are this guy named Corvo, who's sort of like the... I think they call you the royal protector, who's the lead bodyguard for the empress of this country. And you are also basically the empress's lover and the father of her daughter. And she is assassinated at the beginning of the game right in front of you. And they kidnap your daughter, who is the heir to the throne. And then so you are basically... And the people who have assassinated the empress have blamed it on you and then taken over the country. And then thrown you in jail and are about to execute you, but you escape and join up with a plot to sort of kill all these people who have taken over the country and get your daughter back. So that's the story setup. And that story setup, like, of what has happened to you and all the fucked up shit that just happened to you is so extreme that it is very hard for me to justify why Corvo would not kill these guys, right?
Yeah.
Like, it makes perfect sense why you wouldn't kill the random guards, and, like, I'm fine with that, but the whole structure of what is basically the first 2/3 of the game, and there's a really, really obvious third act twist that is just terrible, that, like, kind of changes some of the format of the game in the last third, but the first 2/3 of the game, which is the bulk of the game, is you going through these levels that are designed around you having to infiltrate some place and assassinate a particular person who is involved with the plot to take over the country. And so each one of the targets, you can either just go up and kill them, and that's actually a much easier way to play through the game, or you can always find a non-lethal way to... As a lot of the dialogue is very careful to talk around this stuff, to take care of people. So it's like, So that side of the game just can feel very silly, and it almost kind of frustrated me in a lot of ways, especially with a lot of the events that have been going on in American politics has had me thinking a lot about violence and like the way that media portrays violence and stuff like that. And at first I thought that Dishonored would be a very sort of cathartic thing where you can't play through the game without killing people, but I actually found that that was an incredibly unsatisfying way to sort of to deal with those themes, because the game doesn't actually deal with the themes of violence. It uses the non-lethal approach to sort of just avoid the conversation entirely and to actually like avoid discussing violence and like murder and assassination as a thematic device, because it just does the stupid shit where the non-lethal ways to take out some of the targets are just completely absurd. Like the first one in the game is you take out this guy called the High Overseer, and the non-lethal way to eliminate him is you overhear some guards talking about a like brand of like the exile, and that people who like are being exiled are branded with this like mark, and then they are exiled. And so how you take care of him is you knock him out and like bring him to this chair and grab the brand and brand him as an exile, which I guess means that he is just an exile from the country. They never really follow up on that, but that concept is so mind-numbingly fucking stupid. It blows my goddamn mind that anyone would think that that makes any goddamn sense, because that's not how that fucking works. That would be like trying to take over America by sneaking into the White House and changing Obama into prison clothes while he's sleeping. And then when he wakes up, it's like, I guess we have to throw Obama into prison because he's wearing prison clothes. That's not how that fucking works. You do not exile that guy because he has been branded with the mark. You brand him with the mark because you just exiled the motherfucker. Like, the guy who's running the country's not going to wake up in the morning and see that this guy got knocked out, kidnapped, branded with a fucking, like, cattle iron, and say, well, I guess it says in the bylaws you have to be exiled. My hands are tied. Me, the guy who plotted the assassination of the Empress, there's just nothing I can do for you, buddy. Sorry, you're going to get exiled. And basically all the non-lethal approaches in the game follow that kind of structure of, like, there's a tiny seed of logic in sort of like, well, this is going to get this person out of the way, but in no way actually the non-lethal eliminations or assassinations or however you want to call them do not actually solve the issue of, like, how do we, like, get, like, this person out of our way and stuff like that.
Right.
It's just, like, that side of the game was very frustrating to me. But that's ultimately, I think, a kind of a minor complaint in terms of what the game does well with the level design and the powers and the stealth gameplay.
And it sounds like it's something that they could build upon for a sequel very well.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited for Dishonored 2, because even within the DLC that they released, they showed a lot of improvement in terms of some of the control stuff that they tightened up really well. They changed the blink power, which is a sort of a very fundamental way of you maneuvering around the environment, and they added this sort of like time slow element to that made it much easier to use and stuff like that. So I'm pretty optimistic about Dishonored 2, and I'm very excited to play that when it comes out. But yeah, I think Dishonored is a great game. I think people should go back and play, even if it does have some quibbling issues here and there. I think there's also one or two levels that are not great, and the AI could use some improvement into certain areas. But especially if you play the game non-lethally, that's the best way to play the game, not for story reasons, but because that is the most fun way to play that game, because the way that the powers accentuate your ability to go in and play through levels completely stealthily, that's a huge amount of fun.
Yeah. Awesome. I like a good stealth game.
Yeah.
So I think I'd like this. I might try to kill. When does Dishonored 2 come out? This November?
November.
Okay, no chance I'm playing either of those this year.
Yeah, yeah. Sure.
Nothing against Dishonored, just too much other stuff. But next year?
Sure.
I don't know. I might be replaying Persona 5 over and over and over, so who knows?
Yeah, I think it's a game worth checking out. And the Definitive Edition is really nice. Like, it looks good. The fact that all that the DLC is packed in there is really nice, and it's only $20.
Awesome. Well, I played some new games.
Okay.
I played Lego Star Wars 7.
Okay.
My brother was out of town. He got back into town. We wanted something to play co-op, so I got Lego Star Wars The Force Awakens, because that's one of the last remaining couch co-op games.
That's true.
Still
yeah.
out. And we played the prequel games and the original trilogy. There's one game, but yeah. For each of those. back in the day on the 360, and it's been forever, and I like the LEGO game formula, but I really haven't played a lot of any LEGO games since Star Wars Original Trilogy.
Yeah, which that's the same scenario I'm in. I played LEGO Star Wars 1 and LEGO Star Wars 2, and then did not come back for LEGO Star Wars Batman and Indiana Jones and Jurassic Park and all the billions of LEGO games they put out since.
Many of which I'm sure are just fine, but just haven't played them. But I think because I've been away from it for so long, and because I was playing it co-op, which automatically makes it kind of more fun, LEGO Star Wars Force Awakens was a really pleasant surprise.
Huh.
It's very good. It's got some issues. There are some technical issues with it where I think there were some parts where they did not play test things. And, I mean, there's one part where if you do something in the wrong order, you just have to erase your progress in the level because literally nothing you can do about it. There's things like that a couple of times. So that's not great, and I would put that out up front. That just be prepared, you might see some glitches like that. Although, overall, technically, it's a very solid, good-looking, good-playing game. But it's really fun, and I think it's fun for a number of reasons. Part of it is just having new Star Wars stuff to play with is nice. You know, if you liked the Force Awakens movie and you love those new characters, just having the LEGO versions of those characters and more time to spend with them and getting to play as Rey and play as Finn and do those kinds of things and fight LEGO Kylo Ren and things like that, that's all really fun if you're a fan of the movie. And then on top of that, like, just since the original trilogy game, and I'm sure they've added stuff, you know, incrementally over the different LEGO games they've done, but with this, there's so much more gameplay variety. Like, I remember the original trilogy games pretty much just being running around and solving little puzzles and doing things like that.
There were a couple of vehicle missions and stuff like that, but it was more or less just running around.
But this has a lot more stuff. So you've got the running around and the puzzles, which I think there's less of that, and it's tighter, and I like those parts a lot. Well, there's one part that's really bad, but that's okay. Yeah, everyone gets, like, one bad level.
Sure.
And so you have that. You've got vehicle missions, and you've got a couple different kinds. And, in fact, the space combat stuff, like where you're Poe Dameron and whatnot, that's really fun. And it's like, man, this feels like the Star Fox game we wanted and never got again. But in LEGO form in space. Oh, well. So that's kind of... It really does look like Star Fox 64. Like, not the graphics, but it feels like you're playing Star Fox 64 or something.
Sure.
So those are fun. You've got some actual, like, third-person combat stuff where you fire your blaster and get into cover.
Yeah, I played the demo for LEGO Star Wars Force Awakens, and there was a part in there that you did that where it's, like, it's sort of like a pseudo-third-person cover thing.
Yeah, it's very simple, but you have that. You have some other new kinds of puzzles and builds to do what they call master builds now, where you have to... You can have a stack of Legos and you can put them in different directions. So overall, it's a very well-paced game. And I think part of it also is I think it's kind of nice that they just had one movie to do the game with because I just remember the prequel game and the original trilogy game at some point feeling like there's too much stuff. Like they've got three movies to do. They've got all these levels to explore. You've got all these collectibles. Like it's and it was really long and just a lot to get through. And with Force Awakens, it's like a nice, focused campaign. You can probably do it in 6 or 7 hours, just the campaign. It's 10 chapters. Each chapter is pretty good. There's one that feels like utter filler, where you're back at the Resistance base after you meet Leia, and you just have to get some stuff together so you can leave the Resistance base, and there's some really awful puzzles in there. And it is fun, because you get to play as Leia, and Leia has an awesome... Her, like, jump-forward thing, she basically just does, a roll... And it's kind of funny to see LEGO old Leia do that.
Yeah.
But other than that...
I don't think we're going to see Carrie Fisher do a lot of, like, action stunts in Star Wars Episode 8.
No. But, so that was fun. And the cutscenes and stuff are just fantastic. They have not lost a beat on that. They have, of course, in the years since the original trilogy, added voice acting in.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed to see. It's got the voice acting... But it is, still has the LEGO sense of humor. It's got that LEGO kind of sense of heart and just silliness. And so it's a lot of fun to see all of that. They have most of the actors from the movie are in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the most amazing one is Harrison Ford recorded new dialogue for this thing. And there is a part where he says, "Chewie, we need to get you your Wookiee cookies." And there's a mission where you have to get Chewie his Wookiee cookies.
Okay.
It's the most amazing thing Harrison Ford has ever done as an actor, is say the line, "Wookiee cookies."
And he's not talking about baked goods. That's not what a Wookiee cookie is.
What's
I think
a Wookiee?
We all know what a Wookiee cookie is.
All right. So that's fun. You got Daisy Ridley and John Boyega in there. The only person I could not tell if this was actually them was Oscar Isaac as Poe Dameron. I don't think they got Oscar Isaac. I could be totally wrong on that. But, like, I could tell Kylo Ren was Adam Driver.
Yeah.
Mark Hamill doesn't have any lines, so there's that.
But he mo-capped, like,
He mo-capped the Lego guy? Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. So the cutscenes are just a ton of fun. As always, they're almost the most fun part. Like, you get to the gameplay, and that's good, but then you get to watch the cutscenes, and those are great. So I loved all of that. And then you, as you go along, you do unlock some bonus missions that are, like, side stories to the main movie story. Things like Poe Dameron going to rescue Admiral Ackbar, and then you get to play as Admiral Ackbar, and his special thing is he can go underwater and, like, do things like that.
Yeah, he's a fish guy. Of course.
And Admiral Ackbar, oh god, the funniest cutscene in the whole game is when, so you go to, like, the First Order base or whatever to get Admiral Ackbar, and Poe runs up to the cell and he's like, "Admiral, I'm here to rescue you." And Poe, and Admiral Ackbar looks at him and goes, "It's a trap!" And it's very funny.
Of course, yeah.
It's good. The way they use that line is very funny. So, very much enjoyed this game. I got it with, like, a gift card and on sale, so I don't know if I would recommend paying a full $60 for it.
Yeah.
Although, you know, mostly Thomas and I, we played through the whole campaign and some of the bonus missions, and then he got tired of it. I would still like to keep playing and get some of the collectibles and stuff. And you could play hours and hours and hours of this thing. I mean, as with any Lego game, there's a lot to do.
Yeah, you just blow up everything and pick up all those studs.
There are lots of studs, and there's lots of characters to unlock. Like, even though this is one movie in the game, I do think it has more, like, characters to unlock than either of the previous Lego Star Wars games.
Jeez.
Because it's got, like, 217.
And I have to imagine they're probably, like, plumbing, like, the history. Like, it's not all characters that, like, it's not, like, every single background character that appears in Force Awakens.
No. You can get Darth Vader, for instance, and things like that. So that's a lot of fun. And actually, Darth Vader is really fun to play as because when you're in the third-person parts and you do the blaster shooting, he just uses the Force, and he just, like, takes his palm and just Force shoots people.
Okay.
So I like that. And I think other Force users do that, but I've only played as Darth Vader. Because obviously within the movie itself, you don't really play as a lot of Force users because Rey doesn't learn how to do that till near the end of the movie and all that. So, but it's very good. It's very fun. I would like to play more of it and get some of the trophies and get some of the collectibles and things like that. And we'll see if I have time to do that. I'm still on my Dragon Ball Z kick, and that is somewhat all-encompassing. But but LEGO Star Wars, a really good LEGO game and a very good Star Wars game. One of my favorite Star Wars games I've played in quite a while because we haven't really gotten
into they have, like, made much other than Battlefront or the like, fucking mobile game.
And I feel like part of why Battlefront felt like a missed opportunity to people is, like, we've got this awesome new movie. I want to play stuff from that. And that's not what Battlefront is. And I do like that. This is just... Yeah. And I think it's the thing that was true about the old LEGO Star Wars games is that they are good Star Wars games.
Yeah.
And they are LEGO games also, but they're also just good LEGO Star Wars games. And this is very true of LEGO Star Wars 7. So it's a lot of fun, and I would recommend it to people who like that kind of game. Probably not going to be like a top 10 list game for me this year, but I really enjoyed it, and, you know, fun to play another couch co-op game on the PS4. I don't get to do that much.
Yeah, it's a dying breed of game, you know? Like, even Halo doesn't have fucking split-screen co-op anymore.
That's a shame. Yeah. I will say this, though. They have added, and I've seen this in, like, demos I've played of other LEGO games, since Original Trilogy, they've added that dynamic split-screen thing.
That fucking shit is awful.
Oh, my God. It gave Thomas and I a headache, and we turned it off almost immediately.
I think the old LEGO Star Wars games had that. I think it was off by default.
They did? Okay.
I'm pretty sure they had the dynamic split-screen.
You could be right. I'd seen it in, like, LEGO Harry Potter and stuff, where I played the demos, but...
I'm pretty sure. I might be wrong about that. I mean, it's definitely been in the LEGO games for a long time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And there is a LEGO Star Wars game neither of us have played, which is the Clone Wars one. And I don't want to pretend that didn't happen. But I know people like that one, too.
I forgot that they made a LEGO one of that.
Yeah. Hey, people really like the Clone Wars.
It's a fucking really good show.
It is. I have not watched a ton of it, but what I have, I was very impressed by.
They are writing an Ahsoka Tano book that takes place between Clone Wars and Star Wars Rebels. I kind of want to buy that.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right, other game I've played, and I'm not so positive on this one, which makes me very sad, is Bravely Second.
Oh.
I finally started playing that because I finished LEGO Star Wars, and I kind of wanted something, I was kind of craving some kind of RPG thing, and I was like, oh, well, this is a good time of the year. I could go catch up on Bravely Second, which, when it came out, I got it because I wanted that nice collector's set.
Yeah.
And, of course, that sold out immediately. So I got that, and then I just didn't have time to play the game at that moment. I think I was finishing Digimon at the time, which I don't regret it.
Digimon, Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth is one of the best games of the year so far.
Absolutely. Bravely Second, which, and I had talked about Bravely Second, the demo that came out, because they did that same thing as they did with Bravely Default. They did kind of a special demo that is not from the game directly. It's its own little mini campaign. And I was pretty positive on that demo, if you'll remember, where I said, I liked the new characters, I liked the new music, I liked you were in kind of a new environment, and that was fun. The gameplay, very, very similar, but I like the Bravely Default gameplay, so that wasn't necessarily a problem, especially because this is only the second game. We're not on, like, Bravely Third or something, Bravely Fourth, whatever they're going to call the next one. But playing the full game, I've played about 5 hours of it.
Oh, okay.
And that got me through the prologue chapter and some of chapter one. I think Bravely Default had 4 main chapters, and then, of course, if you know the end of that game...
Yeah, it's the infamous ending of Bravely Default.
Chapters 5 through 8 are a very different thing, so I would not call those full chapters. So if this is a similar length, you know, I got into kind of the first quarter of the game. And I, every time I sat down to play that game, I found myself wanting to play it less, Bravely Second, where I would play it for like 10 minutes and I'd be like, I really want to do something else. And there's so many reasons for it. The first thing I would say is it's not a bad game. It is a good game. I can't really point to anything that I think is bad about the game. It is technically solid. The battle system and all of that is as good as it ever was in Bravely Default, and there are a couple of really nice enhancements they've made to it, especially where you do your grinding stuff, because once you get far enough along in the story, you can do this thing where if you win a battle in one turn, then you get the option to do a second battle that's a little harder, and if you win that in one turn, you get to do a third, and each one you get more experience, and it's an experience multiplier, and that's kind of fun, because it's this big risk-reward kind of thing, and it actually makes very good use of the Brave default system, because if you use your Braves up early, which allow you to take extra turns, then in that second battle, that doesn't reset. So you could have your characters like all -4, and the opponents could like wipe you out if you're on a harder difficulty.
Yeah.
So you've got to be careful with that. So I really like that. I think it's a very smart mechanic. And if anything, it's kind of surprising to me they didn't think of that for Bravely Default 1, because they thought of so many things for that. But the story in Bravely Second, and I think the world, is really lacking. Because the first thing you notice is it feels way more like an expansion pack or something than it does a sequel, because you're just on the map of the first game. You start in a new zone, this new town called, I forget the name, Genealogia or something. No, that's the name of the main character. But you start basically in the...
It's two very different things.
Yeah. Well, it's Genealogia or something. They all have weird names. But you start in basically the town where the Crystal Orthodoxy is found.
Okay.
And so that's where Pope Agnes Oblige is, one of the characters from the first game. Again, the names are all fantastic. They haven't dropped the ball there. But, so you got that, and you're in that town, and that's new, and then the area right outside it is kind of new, although none of it is new in kind of an interesting way. Like, the first dungeon you do is a forest. Yay! Not exactly feeling like they're doing something new and bold.
Yeah.
And then as soon as you get out of that, you are back in one of the towns from the original game, and you're going back literally through dungeons from the original game and stuff
and
like that.
It is like, it's not just that it's named the same, it's like the same kind of geography and enemies and stuff.
I mean, cut and paste. It's okay, the exact same thing. There might be new enemies here and there, but, I mean, the goblins are the goblins.
Right.
You know? And so that's kind of disappointing, but I think that wouldn't be as disappointing if the story felt like it was really justifying it. But the story feels very just rote to me. It's basically Agnes, the Pope of the Crystal Orthodoxy, who was one of your companions in the first game. She gets kidnapped because... And it's... This is the weird thing, is the first game had all this kind of political intrigue between the different... empires and stuff within this kingdom that you're in. And in this one, it's just there's an empire you've never heard of before, and they're the ones who come kidnap Agnes, and they want to wage war. And that just felt like so out of left field to me, having played the first game. The other thing is Bravely Second just starts. Like, it has a little recap cutscene when you launch the game itself, but when you start, like, a new file, it just starts, like, in a battle where Agnes is being kidnapped, and you have no context for anything. There's not even like a little animated cutscene or something to get us going, which I think Bravely Default had. So it's really jarring on that level, especially because, as I said, the bad guys are an empire you have never heard of, and they're just here. I don't know where they are geographically. Like, that itself does not make sense to
me. They're from the south. They just keep going south. You'll hit it eventually.
Anyway, so you play as Yu, who is one of the three cavaliers who are the defenders of the Pope of the Crystal Orthodoxy. And that's kind of fun at the beginning. You have the three cavaliers, although this was another weird thing. It starts so abruptly, you have no real time for character development. And so the only reason I felt attached to any of the three cavaliers is because I played the demo where you met them. But then you find out the demo could not have happened because it's clearly out of continuity.
Oh, okay.
So that was weird.
That's really weird.
So anyway, and then it just barrels through story at an exhausting rate where nothing really has time to grow or develop, because then you find out the other two Cavaliers are traitors.
Oh.
And they betray you and they join the Empire. And then
you only played, like, you said, like 5 or 6 hours of
yes,
the game.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And this is like hour one.
Yeah, that's pretty fast development there.
Yeah, and of course you're supposed to be like, oh, you is so sad. And it's like, but I don't know any of these people. A betrayal doesn't... It's if, like, when Darth Vader met Luke in movie one and said, I'm your father, that would mean nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just like the first scene. Like, they get onto the Death Star and Vader looks up, oh, hey, Luke! I'm your dad!
Yeah, that's kind of what it's like.
Long time no see, sport.
And so then they try to get the main party of four together really fast in what feels like it should be a good half the game, because there are a lot of dramatic stuff here. So first you meet... Edia, who was one of your party members in the first game, she's like the daughter of one of these other kingdoms, and she's a really good warrior and stuff. It's kind of nice to have her back, but again, she just kind of comes into the game, and then you're together with her and you, and then, this is the weirdest part, the girl on all, like, the promotional art for Bravely Second, if you've seen the covers and stuff, right, is this woman named Magnolia Arch, and she was teased at in this big cutscene at the end of Bravely Default, the North American version, which was like this big augmented reality kind of, not augmented reality, but you could, like, almost virtual reality on the 3DS where you could move the thing around and
sure, yeah,
was all like that. And so she's introduced in that in Bravely Default, and so you think she's going to be like a really big important character in this one. And she is, because she's a party member, but her whole backstory is she's from the moon and has come to Earth.
Okay.
And literally how they do this is you're in this little cabin that, again, is just from the first game. And if you go outside the cabin and you go down the road, they've put in this, like, little airship that has crashed, and you find Magnolia in there, and there's all this weird, like, alien tech. And they're just like, she's like, I'm from the moon. You want to join up? And that's it. That's all you know about Magnolia.
It's no, like, what is it like on the moon?
None of that. And it's very...
Do you guys have, like, cool robots or something?
It's
what do you do?
It's very bizarre, especially because in the demo where you meet Magnolia, she made a very strong impression. I thought she was a really interesting character. And here she's just kind of along for the ride. And it, like, to the degree where it feels like this game may have had, like, a giant, massive script rewrite at some point where Magnolia was bigger and they just decided to go in a different direction. Because the next part is you have to go to save Tiz, who is the main character from Bravely Default. And at the end of Bravely Default, Tiz falls into a coma.
Okay.
Because, like, he had this mission, and when it's done and he, you know, you beat the game, he, like, basically falls into this coma, and it's kind of almost a cliffhanger or something. And so you go to rescue Tiz, and when you get to Tiz, it replays that preview cutscene from the end of Bravely Default.
Okay.
But in context, it makes very little sense, because Magnolia has not been characterized the same way. The cutscene very strongly implies she is rescuing Tiz on her own. That is not the case. All of this stuff is very bizarre. And then once Tiz is out of his coma, it's so perfunctory, like, well, why were you in the coma? What was the point of this narratively? Nobody knows. We have to go rescue Agnes. It does feel like there was a different story they were building up to, and whatever.
That just sounds like it feels like someone else, like, wrote the script for Bravely Second. Some of that had, like, nothing to do with Bravely Default,
which I don't believe is the case.
Yeah,
but you're absolutely right. That's what it feels like. And so that, when you get through all that, that's basically the prologue, is getting your team together. And so that's probably 3.5 hours, but it feels way longer because all this stuff happens, but none of it really has any impact. And you're on repeated maps and dungeons, and that's not very interesting. And then I started chapter one, and it's not very interesting. And so for the most part, it just makes me feel like I want to go play Bravely Default again.
Right.
If I want it, because it's like I'm replaying that game with less interesting characters and a less developed story. Because a lot of this wouldn't bother me as much if I hadn't played Bravely Default, which I think establishes its characters and their relationships very well and much more succinctly than this one does. So just as a point of comparison, it really kind of falls apart. It's not a very dynamic sequel. And of course, 5 hours out of a 60-hour game is not a lot. But I feel like I should be hooked somewhere in those 5 hours, and I'm not at all.
Yeah, like, that sounds like a very bad opening. Like, even if it does sort of all of a sudden, it's like, oh, we're on the moon now, and everything's amazing, and it's all new stuff, and, like, the story gets really interesting. It does, like, you need, you know, like, Persona 4... I feel like hooks you right from the start with the story elements. Like, even if it takes a long time for the whole, like, the battle system and all that stuff to get introduced to you, like, a good JRPG should be able to grab you right from the start. Like Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth has a fucking amazing opening where you're like, what is going on? What are these people talking about? I have to understand what's going on in this world. And it just sounds like Bravely Second is not doing any of that.
Persona 4 is a great point of comparison, and I understand it's an unfair point of comparison because
It's so good.
But Persona 4 does also have like a solid 3-hour prologue, for lack of a better term, where you don't really get into the freedom of the game for 3 or 4 hours. But I don't think anyone who played Persona 4 would say that's a bad thing.
No.
You are still hooked within that. I did not feel that at all in Bravely Second. I really just was like, okay, one, I don't fully understand what they're going for on any level. And two, this just is dull and uninteresting to me.
Yeah.
Like, there were a couple times where I was set free to just kind of, like, the most fun I had was dungeon crawling and doing just grinding. And that is a good part of a good JRPG, that it can sustain that, but it should not be the best part of any JRPG.
Never.
Yeah. Like, obviously, in Persona games and in Digimon, it's really fun to grind and that stuff, but if that was all those games were, we wouldn't play them.
No. God, no. Yeah, like, the main reason, like, the only way you can get me hooked into Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth to the point where I have, like, level 99 Digimon at the end of the game is if the story stuff gets me involved in it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I don't know if I'm going to finish this game. I've started playing something else, and it's much better. I'll talk about that at some point, maybe.
Okay.
But for now, Bravely Second, kind of boring.
That's a bummer.
It is a bummer. I really like the first. It doesn't do anything to tarnish my opinion of the first game, but I do think, and I kind of thought this at first when I realized Bravely Second was going to be this direct a sequel to the first game. I thought that was kind of strange, but I reserve judgment. It should be Final Fantasy style, where it's a new world, new characters. You can use the same mechanics. But I mean, God, if, you know, Final Fantasy never succeeds when it does the direct sequel stuff.
No, Dress Spheres and Final Fantasy X-2 are so cool.
Well, and I will say this, to the credit of those Final Fantasy sequels, they are not carbon copy
of
EVs.
They go for some crazy shit at the time. Like, they are not just the last game, like, with more story or something in it.
And so I think that's a mistake. Persona does the same thing. Persona does not do direct sequels because I don't think direct sequels to JRPGs work.
It's hard because it's like those games are like 60-90 hours long. You have mined those characters. Like, you cannot, like, you can explore more of those characters, but it cannot be in that same format just again. That's a hard thing to try to do.
Absolutely. So that's Bravely Second. One more thing on my stuff list.
Okay.
My continued adventures with Dragon Ball Z.
Great, yeah.
I've made some progress in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's been 2 weeks.
I just hit episode 147. Last time we talked, I was in the 80s, so it's been a lot of episodes.
Good.
So I got through the Frieza fight.
Yeah. Did Goku win?
He did.
Oh, okay.
Boy, were they running into problems at the end of that.
With
the filler.
It is a very long stretch of that show, for sure.
It's interesting because I tweeted this, and it's very true and worth talking about. It is amazing to me how much of the cultural, pop culture legacy of Dragon Ball Z comes from the Frieza fight.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean the Namek saga. I mean the Frieza fight, Goku versus Frieza, those 20 episodes of people kind of perceiving Dragon Ball Z as people standing around, yelling at each other, throwing a punch, powering up.
Charging spear bombs.
Yeah. And really, everything else in Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z, it can do that sometimes, but that is by no means, I think, the dominant form of how they do things on that show.
Yeah.
But in the Frieza fight, they do a lot of that, and then there's a lot of bad filler thrown in. And if anything, I watched that and I felt bad for the anime staff, because these are clearly very talented people who were in a very tough scenario. If you look at the dates of the manga and the anime episodes, that was the closest Dragon Ball and Dragon Ball Z ever were to the manga. And that's why it was that disastrous. They were like a chapter behind. And it's like, okay, in this chapter, Goku and Frieza threw like 2 punches. Oh God, what do we do? What do we do? We have 20 minutes to fill. Okay, Ginyu's back. He's going to take over Bulma.
I totally forgot about that whole weird subplot.
That's the best filler in the entire Frieza fight.
Yeah.
It's actually kind of fun, even though it makes no sense.
Yeah, evil Bulma.
Evil Bulma. That's actually kind of fun. The one they do after that is the Ginyu Force goes to King Kai's planet.
Oh, right, yeah.
And they have to fight Yamcha and Tenshinhan and Chaozu. And that's like 4 episodes. While Goku is powering up the spirit bomb.
Yeah.
The Genki Dama. It's crazy. And then after that, they really don't have any side filler to cut to. So it's just a lot of drawn out stuff. They do a lot of flashbacks. the final episode where, like, Frieza actually dies, like, after he's cut in half.
Yeah.
And before Goku just blows him away.
Pagetta!
It's a great moment.
It's fucking awesome, yeah.
But everything in that episode leading up to it is Frieza remembers the entire fight.
Uh-huh.
And they cut a clip show of the entire fight from beginning to end. I really felt bad for the anime team at some point.
Yeah.
And it really shows, because after that they do the Garlic Jr. arc, which is 10 episodes, so basically 3 months they were able to build up. And it shows, because once you get into the Cell, Jin Zoninga, and Android stuff, there it's tight. Just there's some filler here and there, but it is very tight from beginning to end.
Uh-huh.
Very good stuff. So, and it's funny, because within that Frieza stuff, when it's good, oh my god, it's good.
Yeah.
Like, when Frieza is cut in half and he's on the ground going, Tasukete! Tasukete! The way Ryusei Nakao does that is just, it like sends chills down your spine. And of course, the next episode is a clip show.
Yeah.
So, you get that. But within those moments and stuff, it's very good. Of course, when Goku goes Super Saiyan, one of the best scenes in the entire series.
Yeah.
And then the next episode, his hair is like 10 feet long. Because they couldn't figure out how to draw it.
Yeah. The early Super Saiyan, there was an adjustment period to sort of how to do it. Yeah. Like, I feel like the color changes from, like, white to blonde every other frame sometimes.
Yes.
Just like, oh, you guys need to fucking standardize this shit at some point. And then they do the next arc.
And so then, finished the Frieza stuff, and I was like, okay, I really like the Namek and Frieza stuff. The anime ran into some problems. Oh well. And then it was time for Garlic Jr. And we talked about this last week. You made it 2 episodes through Garlic Jr.?
Two or three. I think I got to the point where they get up to, like, Kami's tower, and like, they fight, like, one guy, and I was like, I'm out. I'm done.
Okay.
I can't watch this fucking shit.
I watched the whole thing.
Yeah, you're a sad person. You're just a very sad person.
My whole goal of this is to watch all of Dragon Ball Z. I'm not going to crap out at the Garlic Jr. stuff.
But it's worthless. Like, it's just complete trash. It has nothing to do with anything. You don't need to watch it at all.
Can I make my argument for it?
No. Like, why would you? There's no argument to be made for it. It's terrible.
I don't think it's great. I don't think it's particularly good.
Yeah, there you go. Your argument.
But I was entertained through the 10 episodes. I think they're pretty much fine. There's actually some really fun stuff in there. And to me, it's for 10 episodes, we go into movie land. And it's from the it's like a Dragon Ball Z movie.
But no, but it's like 2 or 3 times longer than it is. All the Dragon Ball Z movies are like an hour long. They are short.
They are.
That is way too much time to spend on something with like so little plot and so like and all the new characters are terrible. Like all that stuff is just awful.
It is. To a degree, I don't think all the new characters are completely terrible. Like I like Garlic Jr. Movie 1, Dead Zone.
Yeah,
that's my favorite of the movies. And in the show, he's voiced by Shigeru Chiba, who is awesome. He does Raditz, and I love that voice, so I liked that. I like having stuff up at Kami's palace. I think that's kind of interesting, and a change of scenario for everything. I like having more stuff with Kami and Popo, although that goes on way too long. There's a thing where they go... There's some weird stuff with the lore that doesn't fully make sense, but I think it's kind of fun. So I was fine with it, and actually, when you get... Really, the Garlic Jr. is only 9 episodes, and then the 10th episode is not Garlic Jr. focused, and it's actually a kind of fun filler episode, because it's Umigame's birthday, and the turtle is turning 1,000, and I really liked that. And I thought that was fun.
Yeah, but that, like you said, that's not really part of the Garlic Jr. saga.
But I'm saying, we always say it's 10 episodes, it's technically 9, and then they have that, and we move on.
9 episodes too many.
It's probably 4 or 5 episodes too many. I'm okay with them doing a couple of it.
But, like, at that point, just, like, make another Dragon Ball Z movie. Like, if it was just someone to go and be, like, 2 or 3 episodes long, that would also just feel, like, kind of insane. Go on a little 3-episode plot diversion with that.
And obviously, if anime schedules were sane, what they would have done is just taken 3 months off.
Yeah.
But that's just not how it works. You have to have an episode out every week for one of these big shows like Dragon Ball Z. And I actually think for having to do 10 weeks of filler, I thought it was okay. And I enjoyed parts of it. It's got a lot of Piccolo, my favorite character. He gets to do a lot of fighting. You got your Gohan and Kuririn, and that's fun. And so, it was fine.
I also feel like as soon as, like, it's a really awkward thing when the show raises the bar with, like, the Super Saiyan stuff, and then you have to do this whole, like, 9-episode bullshit where it's, like, you're just, like, under that again. It's, like, it's really hard to, like, adjust to that, you know? Especially when you're, like, watching it in sequence, and it's, like, guys, like, you can't do that and then just, like, have this whole, like, diversion with, like, characters that have nothing to do with, like, the Super Saiyan. Like, that has pushed the, like, all the power level and everything about the show through this whole other scale, and it's, like, immediately going back down is a really awkward transition.
It is. Although, again, we're in movie land, and it's a different thing. And
so as long as, like, you can just say, well, we're in movie land, so everything that's bad is just, it's bad and it's fine, and I don't care. Like, sure, you can use that to justify liking anything, Jonathan.
It's bad in a very different way, and you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's bad and it's awful.
Okay.
It's way too long.
It's got my favorite movie character in it. It's got Haya Dragon. I like Haya Dragon.
Fucking whatever, dude.
I think
is that even really a character? Or is it just? It's just an animal. It's just an animal.
I like animals.
He's flying.
He and Gohan are very cute together.
Sure.
Anyway, once you get through Garlic Jr., you are rewarded with, I think, the best episode of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah. Or you can just skip Garlic Jr. and just go straight to probably the best episode of Dragon Ball Z.
And what I am referring to is, of course, there are episodes around this. Episode 120 of DBZ, which will forever now be ingrained in my memory. I know I've seen it before, but it's been a long time. So now and seeing it in context is a very different thing. It's right. So the previous episode, 119, Trunks shows up. We've got Mecha Frieza and King Cold there.
Yeah.
And all of that. And then the following episode where Trunks fights Mecha Frieza and his men and all this stuff. That is as perfectly paced, perfectly animated, perfectly scored, perfectly voiced an episode of anime or of television, really, has ever existed.
Yeah, it's really, really good.
And the story there is so good. Like, you have to take a moment to appreciate just how good a storyteller Toriyama is at that moment.
Yeah.
Because basically the entire point of that Mecha Frieza arc, that little arc with Trunks, he comes from the future and all that, is to try to up the ante and to say, all right, we just fought Frieza. It was a giant, you know, very long fight, which, to be fair, is also really long in the manga. That does not all come from the anime.
Yeah.
I think even in Kai, it's still like 12 episodes because much happens. But anyway, so you've come from all that. How can we ever have someone stronger than Frieza? Well, here we go. We have Frieza. He's back, and he's a cyborg now.
Yeah.
We have his father, who's bigger and stronger, and this kid comes from the future, turns into a Super Saiyan, and just cuts him in half.
Yeah.
There is no better just throwing down of the gauntlet I can even think of for that kind of storytelling.
Yeah, and that's the kind of shit I'm talking about with, like, when you raise that bar, and, like, you can't go back down. That's not how that kind of storytelling works. You have to, like, you have to trump yourself. And
yes.
So he trunks himself.
Absolutely. And, of course, Trunks is a great, great character.
Yes, he's one of the best DBZ characters.
And anyway, and so I love the Trunks episodes. Those are phenomenal. And then you get on into the actual arc with the artificial humans, and then Cell comes in, and all of that is so good.
Yeah.
And I remember that because this is my favorite part of the manga. It's one of my favorite arcs. I have never, for whatever reason, sat down and watched this part of the anime through sequentially. And it's a long part. It's like 80 episodes.
Yeah.
And I've seen parts of it here and there. I've seen all the Cell games, for instance. But, of course, back in the day when I was a kid, it was kind of hard to sit down and watch this all in order, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if you wanted to watch it in Japanese or something, because that's not on TV.
So,
but now I'm sitting down and watching it in order. It is so good. All of it. Like, and another episode I think is just about perfect is episode, I think it's 142, which is where Kami and Piccolo merge.
Yeah.
And then he goes to meet Cell in Ginger Town, and it ends with Cell doing his Kamehameha.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a perfect episode.
And all the early Cell stuff is so cool when he's like, you don't really know what he is, and he's just like sucking people, like their life out in this town. It's just this town covered in like empty clothes.
It's amazing. I mean, the amount of story that's going on in the entire Cell Android arc is incredible. There's so many twists and turns. And if you look in the history of it, it's a pretty funny story where Toriyama kept introducing villains. An editor of his would say, I don't know if I like this. And he'd say, I can do something new. And so he's just riding by the seat of his pants on all of this. But it feels planned out. Like
it is one of the most airtight time travel plots I've ever seen.
Oh, absolutely. He thinks of everything. Yeah. Because his conception of time travel is that changes make a new timeline.
Yeah.
And so that actually just solves everything.
But it's also the way that whether he intended it to be foreshadowing for the Cell stuff or not, but the way that all the timeline stuff has changed so drastically from Trunks' perspective, and he doesn't understand how.
Yes.
And then you get to the slow reveal of if this other thing has also traveled back in time. That is so perfect. That is such an unbelievable. Again, it's just one upping itself. It's there's time travel, and guess what? This isn't the only motherfucker who's time traveled. Something he time traveled before he even did.
Well, it's amazing because every few episodes, a new mystery is introduced.
Yeah.
And every few episodes, a new mystery is being solved. And so you've got this constant push and pull. So I've watched, about 30, 35 episodes of this arc so far. And there is a little bit of filler here and there, but even when they do filler, it tends to be really good because they've got so much story to pull upon.
Yeah.
Like, there's this episode that, honestly, you have not read this part of the manga, right?
No.
So you might not even think this is filler, but there's an entire episode where Krillin meets Cell at this airport, and Cell is trying to kill this family, and Krillin fights him and all this. That is not in the manga.
Huh.
And it feels seamless. Because it's just more of them fighting Cell, and technically you can kind of tell because it doesn't change anything on the playing field.
Yeah.
But it actually does more to kind of raise the stakes with Cell and give these characters something to do.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing
helps keep Krillin relevant when that's like the last time in the show that he really is still relevant, because he does actually have a lot to do with all the Android stuff and with Android 18 and everything.
So yes.
It keeps him in the show. You know?
Hey, to be fair to Krillin, he is relevant from near the beginning of Dragon Ball to the second-to-last arc of DBZ, so, you know.
Yeah, it's only at the very end. As soon as he grows the hair, it's over. Like, he turned it in, you know.
Yes. Isn't there filler, though, where he and Yamcha, like, have to fight people in hell in the Buu stuff?
I feel like there's 500 filler episodes where Krillin and Yamcha fight people in hell.
Okay.
Like, that's just, like, what Dragon Ball filler is in my memory, basically.
Yeah.
It's like, or it's like Frieza and Cell trying to escape hell and all that shit. Like,
no, but you can just tell how reinvigorated the anime team was when the artificial human stuff comes around, because they have so much to work with. The animation gets better. There are still bad animation days, but it's pretty consistent, and the backgrounds in this part, I don't know who the hell was doing them, they're fucking gorgeous!
Yeah.
And some of this stuff, because there's a lot of stuff in the mountains and in these cities and things like that. The scale of it is very big. Cell himself, he's my favorite DBZ villain. And
okay,
I didn't want to commit to that until I really had sat down and watched more of this. But, oh my god, Norio Wakamoto, who voices Cell, the voice he does for that character, I just giggle with mirth every time I'm watching it. It's so good. The Kamehameha he does, that is my favorite Kamehameha in the whole show, because it's like,
Kah! The
way he does it is so amazing, and I love the design of First Form Cell.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually love Second and Perfect Cell too, but that first form is, I think, really cool and special. And you can see Toriyama drawing on all these different influences, like Invasion of the Body Snatchers and 50s sci-fi and stuff, but giving it a very Dragon Ball spin. And it's a very airtight story. It's a great time travel narrative. And there's all these character arcs being juggled very well. You don't even notice Goku is just out of the show for like 20 episodes with his heart disease.
Out for like most of that entire section of the show.
Yes.
It's not to like the very end after he comes out of the hyperbolic time chamber and all that stuff.
Yeah, and even then he is not the one who beats Cell.
Yeah,
you know,
no, it's the transitionary period that then they went immediately back on. But
well, it is something I'm really noticing is Dragon Ball, the first 150 episodes. That when Goku's a kid and then into the first fight with Piccolo and all that, he is the main character there. Goku is obviously the protagonist.
Absolutely.
I would not necessarily say he is the main character of Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, no, it's an ensemble show.
It's an ensemble, and at times he is in no way the main character of the Cell stuff.
Yeah.
And I don't think there is one main character, but you've got Gohan and Trunks and Vegeta, and all of those are much more major to the series. And if anything, my theory has always been on the Boo stuff. Clearly, Gohan is the main character for the beginning of that. And I wonder if at some point, Toriyama just said to himself, I'm going to be ending this soon. Maybe it's time to go back to Goku. If anything, that feels appropriate because it's the end of things. And it would be weird if the last arc just didn't have Goku in it as the main character. But so I'm halfway through the series. I couldn't be loving it anymore. And the thing is, it feels like I'm way more than halfway through because, to be fair, the second half is my favorite part of Dragon Ball Z. I like the Cell arc and the Buu arc probably more than Frieza and the Saiyans.
Yeah. It's hard for me to like make any of those judgments.
It is tough, and they're huge.
I love them all so much.
I absolutely do, and some of it is just fatigue. I have seen the Namek and Saiyan stuff many more times in the anime. I've read it all in the manga pretty equally, because I've read the manga several times through. But I don't know, there's something about that second half that, for one, the Android stuff is just so different than anything else in all of Dragon Ball.
Yeah.
And then I think the Buu stuff returns to the tone I really love from the early part of the series.
Yeah.
So there's just something about both of those I really love. But the Saiyan arc is pretty much perfect. And Namek, it gets flack for the filler and the Frieza stuff. Up to that point, it's really great. And even then, if you can sit through the filler or just fast-forward it or something, there's so much good stuff.
Yeah.
This is a phenomenal show. It's yes, so good. Yeah. I think a lot of people like it and have nostalgia for it, but I think forget that it is a really, really good show. It is well told. It is well animated. It is spectacularly acted. That is one of the best voice ensembles for anything ever.
Yeah.
Just incredible. So I could not be having more fun with this. And I keep thinking I'm going to, like, take a break to do other things.
No, you can't. I can't. No, that's it's impossible.
My goal is I want to be through episode 200 by the time August rolls around, because we've got games coming out again. And I feel like if I take a break between the Cell stuff and then into Boo, that's a good time to take a break, because the show has a major overhaul.
It's a long time skip. Yeah,
a new theme song, new music, new everything. So, yeah.
Cool. Yeah, Dragon Ball Z. It's still very good.
So good. And then apparently Dragon Ball Super is on a fucking roll right now, is everything I'm hearing. That the Trunks arc on that is just phenomenal. So Trunks makes everything better.
He does. He is a very good character.
Whether he's a kid, an adult, he's just a good character.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even in Dragon Ball GT when he's a wet noodle.
I mean, he's one of the best parts of the early section of that show, and Dragon Ball GT is still okay. It's pretty good.
Absolutely. I don't even know what happens to him. Does he just disappear from that show at some point?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, definitely by the time they get to the, like, Dragon Ball Dragon thing.
The evil dragons and stuff,
Like, it's basically just Goku and Pan, as far as I remember.
And a lot of Vegeta.
Yeah, well, no, not actually that much Vegeta.
Near the end, I think there is.
Yeah, I mean, it cuts back to him every now and then, because he becomes Super Saiyan 4, but from what I remember, it's mostly Goku and Pan doing shit.
Oh, well. Dragon Ball's still good.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. So that's my continuing adventures of Dragon Ball Z. That is all our stuff. Let's move on. We're going to review Inside in a moment.
Yes.
I want to hit our one piece of news first.
Okay.
Which is Pokemon Go. I have not gotten to play it yet, because every time... It's on my iPhone. Every time I go to play it, the servers are overloaded and I can't log in. And it won't let me create an account. So I have not gotten to play it at all. But I've been following the news, and I'm just basically doing an internal countdown to when Nintendo gets sued for one of the many, many catastrophes that are happening because the world was not ready for Pokemon Go.
Yeah. I have been playing Pokemon Go.
Wow.
Well, not have been playing. There's a lot of, like, asterisks next to all those words in terms of, I don't know if I'd really call it playing Pokemon Go, and then I haven't played it. Basically in like 5 or 6 days because I reasonably can't. I would have to go out of my way to a point where I would not want to, because I'm out of Pokeballs. And there's a lot of stuff to talk about in terms of that. But how do you want to tackle the Pokemon Go discussion?
It's
a big topic.
I don't even really care about the game, like, because I think the game's almost incidental.
Yeah.
I mean, Bernie...
It's terrible. It's fucking... It's awful.
It is, and it was really funny. Bernie Burns from Rooster Teeth had a great tweet, which was, imagine a world where all gamers were as patient with game launches as they have been for the buggy Pokemon iPhone game. Because for some reason, people are just ignoring that it's a buggy piece of crap.
Even if the servers... Because whatever, it's a fucking massive phenomenon. Like, it has tens of millions of users. I'm not surprised that they're having huge server issues. They probably did not anticipate, like, having this huge groundswell of just, like, excitement around it. So I can kind of ignore some of the server stuff because it hasn't affected me that much, because I managed to get in early enough before it, like, hit really hard. But even if, like, it never had any server issues and the GPS stuff worked really well, because it doesn't... Like, even if all that stuff was fine, it is just fundamentally a piece of shit game. It is awful. And it's mind-boggling that they have this perfect blueprint to work off of, which is Pokemon, that there's so much that they could have taken from Pokemon in terms of the battle system, in terms of trading, in terms of, like, all the systems that they have in Pokemon that allow you to build a relationship with the Pokemon you catch in different ways. And they looked at all that stuff that would have been very easy to translate to a mobile format, and they just said, fuck it. We're going to basically not have any reasonable battle system other than this fucking stupid Pokemon gym thing. We're going to layer in all these different mechanics that basically make it so that if you don't live in a, like, densely populated city, the game becomes impossible to play after a couple of days. And we're just going to... And we're also going to ignore a whole, like, massive, vital part of the Pokemon fantasy, which is... Like, people going out into nature and being in nature, not just being outside, but being, like, in nature, in the wild. Like, if there's a reason why Pokemon are in tall grass, they're not on the root paths you know? And that game doesn't capture any of that. It doesn't capture fucking anything significant about the Pokemon fantasy. It captures the most superficial element, which is cute little animals that you throw balls at that you then collect, quote-unquote, but then you get to do basically nothing with in the actual game. It sucks.
Yeah, and I haven't honestly even tried to log in that much because it looks so uninteresting to me, and if I want to play Pokemon, I have a lot of good games to choose from.
Yeah.
And I could go back and play any of those, and so this makes very little sense to me, but it has become a phenomenon beyond, I think, really any iPhone game to date, because you have things like Angry Birds and stuff, but that doesn't cause public health hazards and things like that, you know?
I mean, it doesn't really have a capacity to, because...
That's what I'm saying. This is the first augmented reality game to take off like this, ever.
Yeah.
It feels like kind of a sea change moment for things, because this has become an absolute, just like, a level of national conversation that Nintendo has not had since the Wii days.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting to me. It makes me worry in a couple of ways, where it's like... It's like Konami learning about pachinko machines.
Yeah.
Do you just stop making games at the point where you get to put in literally zero effort and make just millions of dollars? Because this thing is probably already more profitable than the last few Pokemon games.
Yeah, I mean, it hit like the top selling app thing, like most highest grossing app. I forget how they label it, because obviously it's a free app that has a bunch of microtransactions in it. But it hit like the top of that list in the Apple Store, like I think a couple of hours after it came up, and it's been there since. So,
yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's
pulling in like millions of dollars every day.
I mean, I go to websites like the New York Times and CNN to get my news every day, and I never see stuff very rarely about video games, less about Nintendo, never Pokemon.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this has been on like the front page of CNN. It's a very strange thing to be seeing.
Yeah.
And it's, what's funny to me though is that while there are cool positive aspects about the game in terms of people getting together and meeting people and stuff, what you're mostly hearing about is two kids have found dead bodies.
Yeah.
This morning, kids were shot at by a guy on his lawn because Americans are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
There has been there was the thing where iOS was giving all your Google information to Pokemon and stuff like that. Like, just thing after thing after thing that I feel like is going to at some point lead to a lawsuit.
Like, the Holocaust Museum had to put up signs telling people, don't play Pokemon Go here, you insensitive fucks. Like, holy shit, what are you doing? Oh my god.
So I don't even know what to make of all of this. It's why I wanted to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
I need to talk to someone about it. It's crazy.
I think it's like, there's a lot to sort of unpack with Pokemon Go. One, it's that Pokemon is a really massive franchise, and I think a lot of people maybe didn't fully understand how big it was before the Pokemon Go shit happened, because everyone has an iPhone or an Android device. Like, everyone has something that can play Pokemon Go in some capacity. And if you are, like, 25, 26, 27 and under, you have some relationship to the Pokemon franchise that is probably going to be positive. Like, because you know, I would kind of think of myself vaguely as a Pokemon fan, but I haven't played a Pokemon game since, like, Emerald. Like, I haven't played one since the early 2000s. But like, you know, I'm still paying attention to Pokemon. And it's like, and people, because the original Pokemon, like Red, Blue, Yellow, like that set, they sold tens of millions of copies of those games.
And
sold millions of copies of every Pokemon game.
And remember, I mean, the Nintendo DS is the second highest selling video game console of all time.
Yeah.
Next to the PS2, and the Pokemon games are up there in like the top 5 selling games for that system.
Yeah.
And on the 3DS, it's got 60 million units in the wild. Pokemon games have sold tens and tens of millions.
Yeah,
so,
and have been selling tens of millions of copies since the mid-90s. So you're catching like generations of people. Plus, there has been an anime ongoing on TV since then as well. So people who have no connection to the games can have an affection for Pokemon by having seen the anime when they were a kid, because the anime was also fucking huge when I was in elementary school. Like, everyone knew, and probably everyone still knows, like, the Pokemon theme song, like, at least a little bit.
I want to be the very best.
Yes.
Like no one ever was.
Yeah.
To catch them is my real test, to train them is
my
cons.
Yes. But anyways, there's also like the Pokemon trading card game. Like when we were kids,
it was
Pokemon
huge.
Was massive. It was everywhere.
I still have somewhere a binder of Pokemon cards that is just huge.
I know exactly where my binder of Pokemon cards is because I was looking at it a couple of weeks ago. I was figuring out where the fuck do I put this thing? What do I do with it?
Yeah.
But yeah, like, so Pokemon has an inbuilt audience of tens of millions of people. It has a huge, like, franchise recognition factor. And then I do think this, like, the augmented reality stuff was, like, a sort of feels now like it was a ticking time bomb, because the whole story behind Pokemon Go is that it's made by this developer called Niantic, which they made a game very similar to Pokemon Go that, like, I haven't played, but from everything I've read and heard about it, sounds like it was actually a lot better of a game than Pokemon Go, called Ingress, which had all, like, that augmented reality stuff, and you're, like, taking over bases and stuff. And all the information that the game pulls in terms of, like, where Pokemon gyms are and, like, Pokestops are and, like, different real-world locations you can go to get items and stuff like that, all that data is pulled from Ingress, their previous game. And then the game is published by the Pokemon Company, which is not Nintendo. And I think it's important that people know that while Nintendo is definitely getting a lot of money from this and has, like, a stake in this, Nintendo did not make this game. Nintendo, the company, basically has nothing to do with how this game got made or anything about this game.
Pokemon is like a second-party game to Nintendo. They don't make for anyone else, but the Pokemon Company and Game Freak, which used to be two separate things, but I think they're one now, is its own entity. And in fact, it's a huge company. Before even this, I mean, Pokemon Company International has been doing its own in-house dub of the Pokemon anime for like 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
So like the new voices, that's just, that's not like Viz or Funimation or someone did the dub. They just have the money to do their own in-house English dub for the West.
Yeah.
So they're a big company.
Yeah, so Pokemon Company like licensed out this to Niantic, who had the experience making this augmented reality stuff. They leveraged the data they had to make Pokemon Go. And I think it's just the combination of, one, the game targets dense population centers, so it targets cities, and it incentivizes people to go outside, which, if you're living in a dense city, you need excuses to go outside because there's not stuff to do outside. Like, there's not, like, nature, really. There's just more buildings and more streets. And then, like, Pokemon has this recognition factor, the augmented reality element of, like, oh, you're walking around and you see, like, through your iPhone camera, like, an image in front of you of, like, the street or whatever. And, oh, there's a little Rattata, and it doesn't really matter that he's kind of floating 10 feet off the ground, and he's kind of sideways, and you can't figure out why, because that augmented reality stuff can make really good screenshots if you, like, position everything right and you take time doing it. But when you're actually using the game, it looks janky and clunky as all fuck. It is, like, it looks terrible. But it allows you to send funny screenshots of, like, a Pidgey sitting on the head of, like, a dude working on the sidewalk or something, you know? And, like, all that stuff, like, allowed it to take advantage of social media, take advantage of this inbuilt Pokemon audience, and take advantage of something that everyone, like, through a device that everyone owns, and it's extremely novel because the vast majority of the population has never seen a game like this before. And then it targets people that living in the dense populations, that encourages them to go outside. That also makes the game feel incredibly social because you will see other people playing the game, even though the game does not have any social functions built into it whatsoever. You cannot battle with other people other than, like, asynchronously through, like, gyms, so you're not directly battling people if you're battling in gyms. And you cannot trade Pokemon with people. You cannot trade items with people. You cannot communicate through the app. You cannot have, like, a friends list or anything like that. You do not, like, the app does not, like, interact directly with other apps, like, other phones at all, at any level. So it is social on the most superficial level, but it does have that social element to it that encourages people and, like, sort of makes them feel good for playing the app, even when they are just walking around staring at their phone. And the number of different fucking articles I've read online of people talking about the fun times they've had with Pokemon Go and talking about, oh, it's such a social experience. And they have this story that's like, and I saw a couple of kids at the park and I was like, hey, are you playing Pokemon Go? And they're like, yeah, I just caught a Bulbasaur. And then I walked away because any more social interaction would be awkward. I mean, they don't say that. But that's like, that's not social interaction, guys. That's going, hey, you're playing that game too. Well, we're not going to have any further conversation. There's nothing we can do with each other in this game. You can say, there's a Rattata around here, but that's not how the fucking game even works. You don't catch Like, the game just generates Pokemon for you. It doesn't generate Pokemon for other people. So, it's, like, them saying, like, oh, yeah, there's a Dragonite over here. It's like, not in my app, you dumb motherfuckers. That's not how this works. I don't understand what people are doing when they're, like, walking around playing Pokemon Go together. Because there's nothing to do when you're playing Pokemon Go with other people. You're just playing Pokemon Go by yourself next to someone else playing Pokemon Go by themselves.
It's a weird thing where I feel like Pokemon back in the day, or just with its normal gameplay functions today, is more social on a much deeper level, because you would, I remember in school, you would have, everyone would have their Game Boy and you'd get your trading cables together, yeah. Or you would play the card game, or you would talk about the anime, and there was actually
Or you talk about, like, if you go to the Safari Zone, that's how you get the Surf HM and stuff like that. Like, I remember having tons of conversations in elementary school, like after school or like before class started or something, about like, oh, this is where you find this Pokemon, or oh, I found out like you can only get like Gengar if you trade Hauntar, and like stuff like that. Like, there's a lot of stuff built into how Pokemon work from the very business level of having the red and blue game separate, that like not only encourage but like to fully play the game forced you to interact with other people.
Yes. Pokemon Go is a very strange thing. But as you say, I mean, when you break it down, it does make sense. Not because of the app itself so much, but because of the presence of an app.
Yeah.
Why Pokemon would take off this way. And it has been funny to see. I mean, there's a lot of, for lack of a better term, older people online.
Yeah.
Who I didn't. They all think Pokemon just was something from the 90s and never existed again.
Yeah.
And ignoring that, as you say, more and more kids get hooked on Pokemon every year. It is an evergreen thing. It will always be around, and it is something that gets more fans all the time. It does not have that same level of broad cultural penetration it once did, but frankly, most things today don't. I think if Pokemon launched for the first time ever today, it wouldn't have achieved anything like that.
Probably not.
So,
it was also a very canny move by Niantic to feel that the game only has the original Pokemon. I don't think it has all of them, but it's the Pokemon that it pulls from are all the original 150. So that, because those are the Pokemon that everyone likes, the ones that are most recognizable in it, and will pull in everybody. Because they have been in all the games to some extent.
Yeah, quality aside, those are the only ones you know everyone will recognize.
Yes. And like, it will get like the old dinosaurs like me that only give a shit really about the original 150, and I'll be a stupid sap taking my walks that I take around the neighborhood, like, regardless of whether or not there's a stupid Pokemon Go app around, but I will, like, have it draining the battery on my phone like a motherfucker, because you have to have the app open to use it all the time. It can't just buzz me when there's something around. And so I'm walking around, like, just staring at my phone like a fucking idiot, and I'm going, oh, hey, there's a Cubone! I like Cubones, cool! And, like, it, like, the only reason I kept on playing it was entirely because, it, like, every other day, it would be like, oh, hey, there's a primate. I like primate. Like, he's a cool one. I haven't thought about primate in years, but he's a cool motherfucker. I'll catch one of those. But then, let's finish this conversation by me going through my experience with Pokemon Go. Like, after just, like, the initial, like, oh, this kind of sucks. I'm not really into it. But, like, so the only, like, I live in, like, the suburbs of Golden, Colorado. So it's a very, like, there's not a lot around here, let's just say. There's not a lot of, like, landmarks or stuff that you could have to be... There's no Pokemon gyms anywhere, like, close to within walking distance of my house. And, like, the only time I'm really going to be outside using this app is when I'm, like, taking a walk in the evening in my neighborhood. But there are two Pokestops, which are landmarks that you can go to that, like, every 5 minutes you can get Pokeballs from. But you get, like, three or four. And there are two in my neighborhood. There's one at a playground that's very near to my house, and one at, like, a small, like, it's like, it's called the Turtle Statue, and it's like a small kind of pseudo park with a turtle statue in it that is a little bit further from my house, but it's easily within walking distance. So when I was using the app, I, like, kind of adjusted my walking path to go past those areas a little bit and to get some of that stuff. And I did have a couple of moments of seeing, like, oh, there's this, like, 16-year-old kid living in this neighborhood, and he's clearly using Pokemon Go. And I'm like, hey, you're using Pokemon Go. And he's like, hey, you're using Pokemon Go. And it's like, I don't want to talk to you anymore because you're like 16 years old. And you frighten me because you're probably like playing Minecraft all day. And like, you're going to be the death of society. So stay away from me. You're creeping me out. And so, but I would like, you know, so for a couple of weeks, I was kind of doing that, walking around. I was getting a lot of Rattatas, getting a lot of Zubats. Not super thrilled about those, but every once in a while there would be a Mankey. Every once in a while there would be a Ponyta. Every once in a while there would be a Cubone, and I'd be pretty happy about that. I was also very happy that I got in early enough that I got my Pokemon trainer's name is Red Pokemon, which I think is a pretty good name for a Pokemon trainer, because Red is the canonical name of the Pokemon trainer, and I think Pokemon is a funny last name for a Pokemon person to have. So I was going around as Red Pokemon. Once I hit level 5, you can join a team that's like the red team, the blue team, or the yellow team. That's like some of the gym stuff is involved with that. I've only done a little bit. I went out of my way a couple of times when I was in more densely populated areas to find a gym and engage with that stuff. And the battle system is this awful real-time thing that was incredibly glitchy for me because of server issues, so I just basically ignored it. So I joined red team when I could because, again, it's red team. I have my Charmander. But I got incredibly frustrated because the game does not really give you any means to do anything with the Pokemon you collect. Like, you cannot battle wild Pokemon. You cannot level up your Pokemon by battling. You can only level up your Pokemon by basically feeding them, like, consumable items that you get by catching Pokemon or by spending real money for, like, in-game currency and stuff. And that's not very satisfying. I mean, you can evolve Pokemon that way. But it's much easier to just, like, wait until you find a, like, higher level Zubat in the area than to, like, feed him items to level him up. So, like, all the stuff of, like, feeding your Pokemon to try to level them is not engaging, and it does nothing to build up a personal relationship with them. So, like, I have my Charmander that was my starter Pokemon, and I've basically done nothing with him because it's, like, there's nothing to do with him. So, I was becoming very dissatisfied. And then when the weekend came around, which this would have been last weekend, every once in a while there's a small... The mountain is too big of a word for it, but like it's called Green Mountain, and it is a small hike you can do that on this like Green Mountain thing behind my house. It's like it's way more than a hill, way less than a mountain. I don't know how to categorize it because I don't want to make this sound like I'm going on some magnificent hike, but it is a small trek, and I do that basically every weekend just for sort of fun. And so I was like, okay, finally I will do this, because this is the Pokemon thing. This is what you do with Pokemon, is you go out into nature. You go on this hike into, like, tall grass with, like, this beautiful scenery and all these flowers and birds chirping. It was like, this is like when I was a little kid, I would go out onto Green Mountain with a backpack and, like, a baseball cap and pretend I was a Pokemon trainer, because that is the Pokemon fantasy, is I'm like an 8-year-old kid, and I'm, like, going out on my own, and I'm, like, having to forage for myself and hang out with my cool animal buddies. That is the fantasy that Pokemon has. So I was like, obviously, I'm going to go out into Green Mountain, where it's like, once you get up on that peak, like, there's no major roads anywhere. Like, there's, like, it's just nature all around. I'm the only person up here. This app should have Pokemon for fucking days out here. I should be drowning in Geodudes on this bitch. You know? That's what I was hoping my hike would be, but it didn't trigger a single Pokemon. It was like an hour up, like an hour like round trip, so 30 minutes up, 30 minutes back. Not a single fucking Pokemon on that entire hike. And that's when I knew this game is not made for people who are actually out in nature. It is made for lonely city slickers who don't know what a tree even looks like anymore and are just trapped in their urban death pit and like want to like feel like they have some connection with like some element of nature. And the way they do that is walk around on the fucking paved sidewalk and stare at their phone every day and walk past the sandwich shop every 5 minutes to get some more Pokeballs. It's like, that's not Pokemon. That's the exact opposite of Pokemon. The cities in Pokemon are like the brief like rest stops you take on your actual trip, which is all the pathways between the cities, not in the cities themselves. And so like that was what made me, that combined with a couple of days later, I ran out of Pokeballs because I was using up Pokeballs way faster than I could reasonably get them for the two Pokestops in my neighborhood. It's like, I'm done. And so I deleted the app. I said goodbye to, like, the level 3 Charmander or whatever it was that I never got to do anything with. I laid Red Pokemon to rest, and now I will forever be, like, an old man yelling at all the people playing Pokemon Go, because fuck those people. They don't understand what they're doing. They don't understand they're destroying society.
If Nintendo should take any lessons from Pokemon Go, what do you think they should be?
That you can make a really shitty app, and as long as you slap Pokemon on it and you throw in some microtransactions, you will make millions of dollars every single day.
That is true, and I think, though, that's the bad lesson to take from this, and I hope it's not the lesson they take.
No.
I do think if there's a larger lesson, though, what I am, because I have not played the game,
although
I love hearing you talk about it. What I have thought about, though, with the just sheer amount of cultural penetration Pokemon Go has suddenly got and the amount of attention Nintendo and their IP is getting at this moment is, to me, this is definitive proof that Nintendo should not be a console manufacturer anymore.
Yeah, no, yeah,
and that if their games were on PS4 and on Xbox One and on things like that, and maybe they still had their own handheld or something because no one else really does that anymore, and they are very good at that, obviously. The 3DS sold about half as much as the DS, but that's still like 60 million units. So and I think a lot of people would kill to do that. So anyway, but like imagine if, you know, a Mario game as acclaimed as Mario Galaxy 2 or as acclaimed as... you know, like some of the Mario games, and or Smash Bros. For Wii U and things like that.
Like Mario Kart.
Or Mario Kart or something like that. If that was on PS4.
And Xbox One. And
multi-platform, and everyone could play it, the games would not have to materially change.
Yeah.
They really would not. There are some experiments like Mario Maker that would be harder to do on other people's stuff, but I think that would be mitigated in other ways.
But there would be other, that would be easier to make, where you're not having to design everything around your, like, weird console hardware and everything, that you can just focus on making the game and not the hardware platform.
Absolutely. They would own the world.
Yeah.
They would dominate every video game news cycle. And it would just be positive, because what they make games so well. And imagine if just suddenly you're playing your PS4 and the entire Super NES library is available there.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff. And things like that. You know, that's the greatest games library ever, if you had that kind of stuff out there. Because it's tied behind their walled garden, it's going to be a more and more niche conversation. Like, again, if Zelda Breath of the Wild completely won E3 for people, I think, the domination of conversation. Now imagine if that was on PS4. And just everyone could play it.
Yeah, where there were like 40 million plus consoles already sold.
Yeah.
Like 20 million something on like Xbox One.
That would sell like Grand Theft Auto 5. And I'm not exaggerating.
No,
I think it would.
Absolutely. I mean, Nintendo is one of the few publishers of games that has hits like that. Like Mario Kart on the Wii, which sold like 30 million copies, you know?
Yes.
Like, they are in Grand Theft Auto territory. Like, they are in, like, Call of Duty at its absolute peak, like, kind of reached that, you know?
So
there's very few properties of video games that hit that kind of saturation.
And, you know, I think you and I have said this all before, and the thing with Pokemon Go is it's just because it proves that Nintendo can reach this level of cultural penetration and discussion.
Yeah.
That is so obviously the direction they need to move in. And if they want to have some mobile apps with that, that's fine. But I think for them to do what they do well, they should be doing it in the larger cultural conversation.
Yeah. I mean, I guess to go back and give a more serious answer to the, like, what are the lessons to learn from Pokemon Go, I think, one, I suspect that this app's not going to last much more than, like, a month in the limelight because there's not much to do with it. And I know that they're, like, Niantic is talking about, like, adding in trading and stuff like that, which is nice, but I think it's, like, a bandage on a, like, fundamentally flawed product.
Yes.
I think, like, the hypothetical Pokemon Go 2... I think there's a lot of stuff you can do in terms of looking at, well, and it's understandable that Pokemon Go is as sort of like thin and anemic as it is, in the sense that it's one of the very few games of its kind. Niantic is one of the only like people making these kinds of games. Like, there have been some experiments on like the PSP and stuff in the past for these kinds of ARG games, but they are incredibly rare. This is the first one that's ever hit, like, it's hit massive, and like none of them have even like been a blip in like the public consciousness. Like, most people who play games have no idea that these games have ever even existed. Now the whole world knows that they exist, and I think that there is a platform now for Niantic or whoever else wants to make these kinds of games to go in and say, well, this is a starting point, but how do we make this better? How do we look at the social consequences of this stuff? Because there has been a lot of really terrific writing, if you're following video game writing, about all the different aspects about like how this game affects society, how it affects different people in different like socioeconomic circles differently and stuff like that. And how there are negative consequences of this kind of game. And, like, you need to take those problems very seriously. But then also, how do you make a real game around this that is more than just you walk around and see like a virtual frittata in the like in your real world through your camera, and you flick a Pokeball at it. Like, how do you make that a more engaging experience that has like RPG elements, has an actual battle system, and can make that casual enough so that people like that a mass audience can enjoy it, but that also has a depth to it that someone like me could get more sucked into the game? Because I really want to like Pokemon Go. Like, I gave it a real shot, and I thought it was pretty interesting the first couple of times I used it, but it was so shallow that eventually, like, my interest completely bled away. But it did open this window into the idea of, like, well, what if, like, I could, like, have, like, a really short battle with my Charmander while I was having this walk? Or, like, if I could have the app kind of, like, in sleep mode or whatever, but still, like, buzz my phone while I'm taking a walk so I don't have to stare at it all the time. But while I'm walking around, my Charmander is battling, like, Zubats in the wild and stuff like that and leveling up and, like, learning new moves. Like, if you built more systems like that, I think there's a real potential for this to be a really amazing kind of game that does actually really encourage people to go outside and exercise and be more social.
And it's hilarious because Pokemon has done this before better exactly. with the Pokewalker
yeah.
and things like
well,
that.
Well, let's before not be crazy that, with the Pokewalker.
But the Pokewalker was partially what you're describing, which is that...
Yeah, but like... You need the other side of it too. Like
you do,
can't just
you
be
do.
The pedometer with like a little screen on it.
I no, but I'm saying if you take that concept and do it
yeah.
now with the iPhone, you can, and it's all unified. You can do
yeah.
a lot more with
yeah.
that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. So you, yeah, like that side of it, there's a lot that can be done, and I just have a huge amount of faith that eventually we will have Digimon Go, because as we've all learned this year through Digimon Story Cyber Sleuth. If there's one thing you can learn from that, it's that Digimon is the franchise you actually go for if you want to see the good ideas that Pokemon has brought to their like natural conclusion. Digimon Go is what I'm waiting for.
Digimon does what Pokemon don't?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
I am waiting so that I can be a cool Digimon trainer with a cool Agumon that I can make into a Greymon stuff.
The thing is, I've only been a Digimon fan for like 6 months. You say that and I'm smiling. I want
yeah,
that game.
Right? If
yeah.
That sounds like that would be the dopest shit.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be a bunch of lame teenagers into it like hanging around my park like a bunch of fucking creeps.
Also, Pokemon Go, the phenomenon, sounds like the plot of a Digimon game. Doesn't
it? It does sound
like,
yeah, it's that's some way that the evil Digimon are, like, infiltrating our reality.
It absolutely... I would not be surprised if there's, like, a Digimon anime or something at some point in the future that, like, parodies this shit.
Yeah, because it is actually... I had not thought about it, but now that you say that, conceptually, Pokemon Go fits way more with Digimon, where Digimon is, like digital data has become sentient and like takes on the form of these monsters that start invading our actual real world. Pokemon is like fantasy bullshit. Digimon's fucking real. Like, that's social commentary, man.
Yes.
Yeah, Digimon Go. I'm waiting for it with bated breath.
All right, let's go ahead and move on.
Okay.
Inside.
Inside.
All right, if you did not listen last week, Inside is the new game by Playdead. They are the indie developers behind Limbo, which was a big hit a number of years ago, back in 2009 or 10. On the Xbox 360 is where it originally came out, but it's been on everything now. So if you have not played Limbo and you want to, go to the nearest electronic device and you can play it.
Yeah.
Is that right, basically?
Basically, yeah. I think Microwaves just got Limbo like a couple of months ago.
And of course, it's had like 6 years. So that is the trajectory of most indie games.
Yeah.
In any case, Inside, smaller launch for the moment, we've got it on Windows PCs and Xbox Ones. And did you play it on Xbox One?
Yeah.
Okay.
I played it last night, so it is very fresh.
Very fresh. Awesome. Yeah. So I played it last, like 2 weeks ago when it launched. I actually played it the day it came out on Xbox One. We both played it in one sitting, basically.
Yeah. It's definitely a one sitting game.
Yeah.
I don't know when you would, like, take a break to come back to it later.
No. So anyway, my recap of my thoughts. I gave a review of it, spoiler free, last week. I love Inside. I think it's a fantastic game. I think it's a wonderful mind fuck, and I found it to be very fun and deep and engaging. Sean, I have no idea what you thought of it. Give us your spoiler-free take. We'll let you know when we jump into spoilers.
Okay, yeah. So, I do feel like I should go back again and like preface that I am very fresh off of this, so like it's still kind of cooking for me a little bit. And I've been like reading a lot about like other people's reactions to it in forums and stuff this morning, just sort of like get an impression of how people are taking the game. It's something that, like, I think there's a huge amount about the game that is intensely impressive in terms of the visuals. The animation in particular, I think, is just absolutely stunning. And there's, like, not spoilers yet, but, like, the stuff about the ending is incredible. But I do think I have a lot more problems than other people do with the game in terms of I don't think the game ever, like, is never really cohesive to me. I don't think the disparate elements of the game really come together in a way that felt very powerful to me. And I think like the ending section in particular is really strong and fascinating from a bunch of different perspectives, but I don't think a lot of the journey along the way to get to that point builds up to that. I think the puzzles, some of them can be interesting, some of them I found to be a bit tedious. And overall, even though the game is like only, I think it took me maybe three and a half hours to play, I still think the game is actually too long, which is a weird criticism to have, I feel. But it is when I came away from it, I felt like, man, that ending was awesome. I really wish the rest of the game was more focused the way that this ending was on like that kind of message. Because the more and more I'm trying to sort of pick apart the game in my head, kind of figure out what is it trying to get at. It's obviously, it's extremely abstract. There's no dialogue or anything like that. It is very bare visuals in terms of how you're trying to sort of piece together the narrative experience of Inside, which feels like that is what the game is trying to be. It's not like The Witness, where it's like mostly about the puzzles and the puzzles are so awesome. The puzzles are clearly like, feel like padding to like challenges for you to overcome to get to like different sequences in the narrative through line of Inside. And I just feel like Inside never delivers like a cohesive, strong thematic argument for what it's trying to present to me. It feels like it has a bunch of different ideas and it never focuses on one. And I think by far the most interesting idea it has is at the end. I just don't feel like the earlier elements feel like they contribute to that to me.
This is a very interesting discussion, I feel like, because I think I look at this game fundamentally differently than you do.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's bad, and if anything, I think that speaks well to the game that it allows for that.
Yeah.
And I like it in its abstraction for that reason. But, like, I kind of viewed it as a game first and as this full aesthetic experience, and I really enjoyed the gameplay, and I really enjoyed the puzzle and adventure sections, and I found those very dynamic and interesting, and they pushed me to... I said this last week, last episode when I talked about this, that it did the thing I like in this kind of game where I would try to put some of these things together when they would present us with a puzzle, and for a little while I would think, this is impossible, I'm not sure what to do here, and then it would come together and I would execute on it, and I just felt this absolute rush, and then it would push you into the next section, and I felt like the game actually, to me, had a very good pace of constantly escalating. And spoilers from this point out,
because
I can't talk anymore.
That was very hard for me to try to talk around the spoilers.
So here's where the game got good to me.
Okay.
So I was playing, the first like 20 minutes, half hour is when you're running through the woods.
Yeah.
And that is the clearest like homage to Limbo. Like that's
sure, yeah.
much more, you know, and you're dodging the people and stuff and you have no idea what's going on. You're just this kid. You're either running away or running to. That's a thematic question in the game. And there's these people kind of either after you or incidentally after you. And all of that I thought was fine, but it was just kind of warming up and I wasn't all that engaged yet.
Yeah.
And then you get to this farmhouse. And there's a pig.
Yeah.
And you have to use the pig to break down the door. And I'm that's kind of clever. And then you get in, and you have to pull the pig's tail off.
Well, it's like a weird parasite.
Weird parasite
like on its butt.
On its butt, yeah. But you think it's its tail at first, I thought.
Yeah.
So you get all that, and so that's super weird. And then you jump up on, there's this like rope on the ceiling. You're like, okay, I probably have to use that to get up, and I'll climb, and I'll go over there. And you jump on it, and it's not a rope. It's a like a lamp thing. But then your head goes in it, and suddenly you are mind-controlling in the background things you didn't even notice yet, these dead bodies on the floor, what look like dead bodies, and they rise like puppets, and you, in your little mind-control thing, can move back and forth and have them go back and forth with you, and you solve a puzzle with them, and my jaw fucking dropped, because that was such a wonderful throw-the-gauntlet-down, weird thing in this game that I thought was just gonna be more of what we got in the beginning. I read the Inside, a couple of reviews of Inside, but they were very good to say, it's good, trust us, we're not telling you anything else.
Right, yeah.
And so that's pretty much all I knew about it. And so it becomes this crazy sci-fi thing with this weird macabre avant-garde imagery with the pig and everything. And suddenly you're doing this mind control stuff. And I felt from that point on, the game just consistently delivered those kind of set pieces that I thought were very interesting, kept upping the ante until you get to the ending, which I assume I know what you're talking about, is you get into the, like,
it's
the tank.
The abject flesh.
The abject flesh, okay.
Yeah, and that's you get into what I mentally started to call it.
Okay. And you get into the tank and you join with that giant ball of flesh and then you have to escape, basically.
Yeah.
And so it just gets bigger and bigger until that point. I mean, you're basically headed into this compound. You start in the woods, you get into this, you know, field farm area that looks like Iowa, basically, to me, because that's where I was born. So I just that's the what I associate that with. And then suddenly you're getting to this base, you go underwater, and like I just
weird evil sea nymphs that drown you or and, don't,
yeah,
or make you Aquaman. I don't know.
Yes, so that's all. I mean, yeah, there's that whole section. Oh God, I love that section where I love all the underwater stuff. But then there's this whole part where you basically die. And you're reborn like immortal. It's very strange. Yeah. And I guess maybe this is like my avant-garde film background in film school and things like that. Where I don't always look to connect the dots on that kind of stuff. And I don't need to. I got to the end of that game where the game ends where you as the... I like your term for this. The abject flesh are on the beach. And that's it.
And yeah, it's just like... fade to black eventually.
Yeah, perfect ending, I think.
I thought the final note that it... Like, I love everything about the ending except for the final note just feels sort of, like, lackluster to me.
Okay.
Like, it didn't feel like... Yeah! It felt like, okay. I thought this is going somewhere, like, more sort of impactful.
Okay. I kind of... anyway, we'll talk about that later. But... what was I talking about before then? So you get the flesh on the thing. And but just those moments like that where it's just like moment to moment, I thought the aesthetic experience and how just bold and strange it was, I loved all of that, and it keeps escalating and escalating. And because it's so abstract, I really wasn't, I guess, seeing it as a beginning to end story. I do think there are themes you can pull apart and talk about there, and under certain paradigms, they may or may not hold together.
Yeah.
But that was not the way I was looking at it necessarily. So...
yeah, and I guess, like, and I can definitely see that argument, but for me, like, that just makes it, like, for me, if you're looking at it at that level, the puzzles are, like, extremely unsatisfactory. That I think some of them are fun, but they, overall, I found them to be, like, tedious is the only word I can think of. That, like, I think it repeats too many puzzles, puzzle types, without really complicating them. It demands too many times that you basically... you figured out what the solution to the puzzle is, but you kind of have to do it twice or three times to, like, rip all the planks off the door or to turn the crank all the way and stuff like that. There were a couple of puzzles that whose solutions... in particular, there was the one puzzle where you have to... where the sea nymph thing is after you and you have to hang on the chain to get it to, like, go to the left so you can get further to the right. And that was the only puzzle I kind of got stuck on because I thought I had the solution to the puzzle was to swing... to go on the chain and swing from the chain to the left platform... well, the sea nymph went to the right, and then go back through the door, through the plant, through the area you just, like, swam immediately through and shut it into that room and find a different way out, because I thought the door was so clearly highlighted, and fucker did nothing with the door, and, like, do something with the door. Like, that was the one puzzle I got stuck on that I thought, like, the visual information presented in the puzzle. I felt like the puzzle had misrepresented what it was trying to get me to do, and I got kind of frustrated by that one. But other than that, I just felt like, if you're going to do this kind of game, I want you to eventually, like, maybe combine the elements of the puzzle so it's like I have, like, I have to deal with a nymph monster and while I'm still, like, controlling people and stuff like that. And then, like, the game is never long enough, nor does it ever really aim to, I think, complicate the puzzles and make the puzzles satisfying in a gameplay way that, like, really compelled me. It was mostly me seeking, like, going through to figure out what is going to happen next, what is going to be the next set piece, what is the next crazy thing that is going to happen. And I think all the graphics and the tone of the piece are immaculate. But I am someone who wants, if you're going to go for something like this, that is so abstract and odd, I do want you to have a reason for it. I want you to have an argument that you're trying to make. And I think the game is making an argument somewhere. I just think it's very confused about what its argument is trying to make. Because there are clear Marxist elements to what it's trying to present. There's a clear, like I mean, there's all these repeated themes of, like, water, the abject flesh thing at the end is, like, all that stuff works in a very critical sense in individual sections of, like, you can argue about, the kid is regressing to childhood. Like, the abject is a critical term that refers to when an individual loses the ability to recognize the self from anything around it. So that's, like, that's what that is representing to me. But I don't feel like, well, what the fuck does any of that stuff have to do with the explosions that were happening in the earlier section, or, like, the sea nymph creature, or the more Orwellian aspect of the society that we were seeing before? Like, none of that stuff feels like it melds into a clear, strong argument in the way that other games of this ilk, like A Journey, very, very strongly and effectively do for me.
And I would say, if I were to... And I agree, and I saw a lot of that in the game. I really viewed it as sort of a psychoanalytic dream analysis sort of thing. I mean, that's where I was reading the whole thing, and I didn't take a second of it as literal. I didn't think.
I'm not taking it literal. I'm taking it abstract. But just because it's abstract doesn't mean that it's not making an argument.
No, and I'm not saying that. But I did think if you know, it's sort of to me, it's like a Lynchian or a I don't always want to bring Stan Brakhage into it, but I'm just thinking of different avant-garde film artists now who deal with dreamscapes and things like that. Maya Deren, maybe. And it is this sort of, because of the way it's changing location, in that none of this environment could not exist spatially. But I love how it doesn't make sense. It flows with the dream logic, and I love the dream logic of it. And I love that there are pieces that just don't get explained. Like, I love the bridge sequence, because you go through this whole... the bridge, and it's something is going, explosions in the background, and they could knock you off, like these sound waves or something. We're not sure what they are, and we never really do find out what they are, because they're this kind of abstract part of whatever that dream is. And I do think on the psychoanalytic level, you have this kid, as you say, regressing to childhood, regressing to nothingness, regressing to a lack of self. It's like in a reverse psychoanalytic path.
Sure.
So
I don't think that element of that game builds for that reading for me, really.
Okay.
I don't have nearly as much exposure to the avant-garde film element of it as you do. People listening to the podcast know that I'm an English literature major, so I'm like looking at it more from that side of it. And I do think with David Lynch, I feel like you can do the stuff and you can have the dreamscape and the insane logic and like the huge jumps and stuff like that, and still present to me what feels like a strong, like, even if like it's extremely abstract and hard to sort of like verbalize, an argument for something, like a real idea. I think us criticizing Insight on this level is already putting it at a very high like bar. Like
that you can engage with it is itself a recommendation.
I want to take a step back while I'm thinking about it. Note that like I'm still saying that Insight is a very remarkable game, but that means that we have to take it as a remarkable game and really approach it on that level. And I just think it doesn't quite hold up to that stuff in a way that, again, I think there are games that do, like A Journey, like Gone Home is obviously not abstract in the same way, but I think there are similarities you can compare to like the style of game it is, and say that like Gone Home is much more focused and strong about what it's trying to do and feels like it has this passion to it, this argument, this thesis that it has at its very heart that makes it a very powerful piece of art to me, and a very powerful story. The way that Inside, it feels like each chunk has maybe some of that. The end definitely has that for me in a very powerful way, but like I want those pieces to connect, especially if it's going to be an experience this short. I want there to be like a sense of a progression, you know?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it will come down to how much you like the gameplay and the puzzles and things like that. And I found it very invigorating. I know a lot of people who gave positive reviews did as well. And that's, of course, a wildly subjective thing that makes game criticism very tough to talk about, right?
Yeah.
Whether or not that kind of thing works for you. It did for me. So to me, it being this overall aesthetic, overwhelming experience, and to me that being the point of it, works completely. If it doesn't for you, I understand.
I would say that I think if you're going for it for that, that's where I'm saying it should be a lot shorter than it is.
Okay.
Because that's where it felt tedious to me, is that it's like, I get the aesthetic argument you're making. You do not need to make that for 3 hours. Like, it could be an hour long. It could be 30 minutes long and be as powerful in that regard for me.
It wouldn't have been for me. I mean, I found it solid all the way through. I found it escalated. I liked every scene more than the scene before it. I really... It progressed for me in a very powerful way.
Okay.
So that's me. I did want to hear, so you keep talking about how much you love the ending and you're kind of talking around what you thought about it. So I want to hear your thoughts on the ending.
Oh, I just think that from like an aesthetic standpoint, it's fucking amazing. Like, especially, I talked about it earlier in my non-spoiler review, but the animation in the game is just unbelievable to me. And it's like, but it's sort of like, it was always really incredible and I really appreciate it, especially the way that the boy interacts with the objects around you when you use the X button to sort of like grab things and stuff like that. I think all that stuff is really smooth and just is, in a video game sense, is very tactilely satisfying, as well as just being very well represented on screen. But that stuff just ramps up to 11 when all of a sudden you are this like amorphous, grotesque blob of humanity with all these limbs sticking out of it, just like growling and like making all these weird noises with 100 different voices and stuff like that. And you're just like rolling and kind of running with like 10 legs on the bottom, and just like this massive flesh just grabbing onto like a wall and ripping it off. Like, that stuff is fucking awesome. Just from a like a game design sense, from like a technical achievement and how it represents what you're going for. And then I also think it's just a very powerful, effective representation of like however you want to interpret it, of it being like a Marxist thing, if you want to interpret it as being more like just like a very powerful representation of the abject and it being more psychoanalytic. I think you can take both tracks with it. I think it is just a powerful symbolic image, whatever you want to take from it, in a way that like I just thought was fucking amazing.
Absolutely, and the sense of control in that last part is fascinating to me, because it doesn't control well in the most precise way possible. Like, it's not supposed to be precise controls, but in that imprecision, it's very, very precise.
Yeah, you're, like, just trying to guide. Like, there's a huge amount of momentum to it in the way that, like, there absolutely needs to be. And as part of, like, the... It's almost like a weird power fantasy element of it, in a very grotesque way of just you just breaking through walls, just like running through glass windows and just like rolling over people and killing them and just like destroying everything in your past because you're just this giant mass of humanity and, that just cannot be stopped.
And I love how it kind of repurposes puzzle elements from earlier in the game.
Sure.
So like there's this, and also I think this whole last stretch is fucking funny. Like that's one thing that I've mentioned. I found it laugh out loud funny. In a great way, intentionally. And there's this one part where you have to light something on fire, but there's these sprinklers, and so
you chuck the flaming box over the sprinklers. That is my favorite puzzle solution in the whole game by far.
It's hilarious. Yeah. It's so great. And when you realize that's what you have to do, because I took it under the sprinklers a couple of times, I'm like, what am I supposed to do here? I'm like, oh, you can throw it! And I didn't even realize you could, because as the boy, you don't really do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but as the big amorphous flesh, you can do that. So, very fun stuff. And then, you know, it's absolutely creative, and it is a cumulative thing, because the animations are great throughout, and there is that sense of momentum and movement and precision with the boy. And then when you become the amorphous flesh, it's a very different thing.
Yeah, yeah. That part of the game is... I mean, that's like the part of the game that everyone... It's trying to talk about, but can't talk about because the game's still pretty fresh. But it is by far to me the most remarkable part of the whole game.
Well, and I love it as just the progression of the story where you have this mind control and all this Orwellian stuff, and there's some fun things in there you have to do, like the parts where you have to walk in lockstep with the people.
True,
and so you're going through all of this, and you're wondering, I'm going to get further and further in. What's the answer? What are these people working on? And I love that there really is no answer, and the thing is, we're getting into the midst of this laboratory, and it's an amorphous flesh.
Yeah.
And again, if you go through the dream logic thing, it's not one thing leading directly to the other. To me, it's this nightmare in the middle, and then you get into the REM cycle almost, and your brain just goes fucking crazy, and you're going to connect this into something really silly. And then I did like the last note, where you get out, and you fall down the mountain, and you're there, and because you don't immediately realize it's the end, it takes, like, they do a little soft before the credits come up. And I like that, and I almost applauded at it, because I think it's, to me, it's like, what else would it be? You get out, and there is nothing left. Like, we've exhausted everything. To me, that's completely organic of just the soft ending of we're on the beach and that's it. And I found that kind of audacious and wonderful.
Sure. Have you seen, because I assume you haven't, you didn't like find it on your own because it's fucking impossible to find on your own. But have you seen the secret ending if you get all the collectibles?
I have not.
Do you want me to just tell you? Because it's a really short, tiny thing.
You can tell me. That's fine.
Yeah, it's basically... If you get all the collectibles, you unlock like a thing where you go into a like hidden bunker thing in the farm area, and you can unlock a door by like playing a series of notes that I haven't even looked up how you find out how to, like, it seems like an insanely abstract way to try to figure out how to get to the secret. But you go through into this like underground bunker, and you kind of run through these series of rooms, and you get to the end, and you there's like a big room with like a something is far in the background. And there's a plug on the right side of the wall, and you're playing as the kid, obviously, because you have to like kind of play back to the beginning of the game. And you can run over and unplug the thing, the plug on the right, and the kid collapses. And if you look very carefully in the background, it's like this, almost looks like a kind of like weird like brain on tentacles looking thing. It's kind of, it's so far away, it's hard to make out, but it's wearing one of the mind control helmets. And so when the kid unplugs it, he collapses like he was the one being mind controlled the whole time.
Yes.
Because we're playing as the kids, so we are wearing the mind control helmet on our Xbox One controllers.
Yes.
Yes. I just wanted to mention it because I watched it this morning because I knew it had some sort of secret ending attached to the collectible, so I decided just to watch it because I did not want to find it on my own.
Yeah, and I did not know anything about the collectibles when I played it through the first time because, again, that was like day one. There wasn't anything out there about it, but I learned about it later, and I didn't spoil it for myself initially. I don't really feel interested.
It's nowhere near significant enough that it's not like the true ending to the game.
No.
It kind of means nothing to me.
And to me, this is not the kind of game where I would have any interest in going through and getting collectibles. In fact, that feels antithetical to what it is. But
Yeah. I've stumbled onto like two or three of them over the course of the game just kind of by accident.
Yeah, and I may or may not have. I don't even know.
Yeah, they were like weird green machine things that you pull something out of it and it would shut down. I don't know. I don't know what they were.
Weird.
Yeah. Weird. That is there. That should be, if they ever release like a like boxed copy of Inside, like Packages of Limbo or something, it should just be on the back. Weekly Sin Podcast or Weekly Stuff Podcast. Weird.
And I love weird stuff. If you know me, that is a absolute seal of approval. I like this kind of thing.
Yeah, no, like I like it a lot, but I do think when you're trying to hold it up to like compare it to something, like, to me, like I've said it again and again, but for me, the comparison point personally is Journey. I don't think it quite reaches that level, but it's a very good game.
Okay.
I definitely think people should play it.
You were not a big fan of Limbo. Did you like this more?
Oh, this is way better than Limbo. Like, it doesn't even compare. Like, Limbo is all the problems of Inside with none of the benefits of Inside to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, cool. That's Inside. I'm glad we got to talk about it.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm kind of getting to unpack it a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of my favorite games of the year. So I think this has been a good year for games. We've talked about that before. Yeah. But all right, let's go ahead and move on to Star Trek.
Star Trek.
Yay.
Trek Among the Stars.
It's 50th anniversary this year.
Fuck yeah.
Show's man.
Been around for a long time.
We have
not Doctor Who time, but close.
Very close. They're both 60s. And Star Trek, of course, being a series of television series and movies and stuff, where Doctor Who is one show with a gap.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, where do we even start with Star Trek? I have a couple things I want to get to. Maybe the last thing we can do is my ranking of the movies just for fun. And really, just because it lets us talk about the movies and make fun of the bad ones, because good God, can you do that?
I mean, I haven't watched most of the bad ones, so I can't do that, and I'm happy to not do that.
There's one I can't make it through, and we'll talk about that.
Okay.
But anyway,
it's the Garlic Jr. sagas of Star Trek movies.
I think that's just Star Trek Voyager.
Sure.
But anyway, let's go ahead and move on. Star Trek. Where would we even start with this? I mean, how did you get into Star Trek?
Well, my mom is a really, really big Star Trek fan. Like, she watched it when it was originally on when she was a little girl, and then she also was really into The Next Generation when that was airing, and so it was probably mostly reruns, but I remember seeing episodes of The Next Generation with my mom when, like really she was watching it, and I just kind of happened to be there because I was pretty young. But, like, that was definitely my introduction point to it, and I didn't really get into Star Trek until high school when I first got Netflix. Because one of the first shows I remember specifically the very first thing I watched when we got Netflix into streaming subscription was Star Trek the original series. Like, we went out, we got a pizza, we came back, and like on the trip to the pizza, I convinced my mom, or it might have been my dad, to get the Netflix into subscription on their credit card because I was in high school, I wasn't gonna fucking pay for it. And so then I got home, set that up, and was eating pizza while I was watching Star Trek the original series from the beginning, and I just watched it all the way through, and I fucking love that show. Like, and for me, it really is mostly about Star Trek the original series and the subsequent movies with that cast, and particularly Star Trek II, which we have talked a lot about on this podcast over a number of years. But that is my like real point of affection for Star Trek. I've never watched any of the other series all the way through, though I have seen episodes of all of them. I've seen a lot of the episodes of The Next Generation, but there's something about the cast in The Next Generation that like I really respect and admire, but I've never gotten into them in the way that I got into Kirk, Spock, and McCoy with the original series. That just made it very hard for me to like marathon episodes of The Next Generation. So while I respect The Next Generation, I don't have the love for it the way that a lot of people do and the way that I do for the original stuff. So for me, it's really that original, those first three seasons and the good early Star Trek movies.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I have kind of a similar story in that my dad was the one who was into Star Trek. And it was, he really loved Star Trek back in the day. And he was a fan of all of it, although I think later in life it was more The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that was just, Next Generation was on longer.
It was syndicated to fucking shit. Like, it was on everything all the time.
It was much easier to see. There was more of it. At that time, the movies were coming out. And so that was just kind of his obsession at the time, well, in terms of Star Trek. And I very distinctly remember when Star Trek Nemesis came out, the 10th movie, and it was the last of the original movies before the J.J. Abrams reboot. And this would have been 2002. I remember they picked a very poor date for Star Trek Nemesis, where they released it in the same month as Harry Potter, The Chamber of Secrets, and Die Another Day, the James Bond movie, and it got killed at the box office, because how would you stand up to those two things?
Yeah.
And so my dad, I remember he went to see Star Trek Nemesis on his own, and he was not the kind of person who went to go see movies, really, but he just wanted to see the new Star Trek movie.
Right.
And I was like, and he came back and he'd seen that movie, and I'm like, and he was telling me about it, and I'd seen a couple episodes of Next Generation with him, but I wasn't all that into it. I'm like, oh, I should see some Star Trek. And he's like, okay. And so we started watching Star Trek. And my Star Trek Netflix story actually starts with Netflix when it was original Netflix, not streaming, when it was a DVD service.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we rented a bunch of the Next Generation discs when they were on DVD. And looked really shitty at the time, because until that Blu-ray remaster they did, which is gorgeous, The Next Generation was a really awful looking show. Yeah. And even at the time, like on a CRT, you could tell that. However they edited that series, they did something to it. Because they shot on 35 and then I think edited it on video, and it just looked really awful. But anyway, so we watched a bunch of Star Trek discs in the mail, we watched all the movies together, and so Next Generation was definitely my point of entry, just because it was my dad's kind of thing, and we watched a bunch of discs together like that. So that was a big like thing I had with my dad, is we watched a lot of Star Trek, and that was throughout kind of my childhood, like elementary school, middle school. And then in terms of getting into it more on my own, it was, and I should back up, I should say, I did wind up seeing Nemesis in theaters with him like a second time.
Huh, yeah.
So I saw Nemesis, I must have seen, I think, like First Contact or something off of Netflix, but I had not seen really any of the original stuff, but the first Star Trek thing I saw in theaters was Nemesis, and that was before I'd even seen most of the series. So I saw Data die, and then I saw him alive a lot after that.
Sure.
So anyway, Star Trek Nemesis.
No Spock. People have the Data thing. I like Data. He's not Spock.
I don't think you need to compare them. He is not Spock. I think he is just fine on his own merits.
Sure.
I like Data. They didn't need to try to kill him in the end of Nemesis, but no, whatever. Yeah. Nemesis is an okay movie.
I've seen it. I remember nothing about Nemesis. That's okay. It's just like, that movie, it like has a lot of like, looks kind of green in my memory.
Yes.
That is my prevailing memory of Star Trek Nemesis.
Star Trek
is the color green.
Star Trek Nemesis was the world's introduction to Mr. Tom Hardy.
Right, yes, right, because he plays like
Picard's clone.
Picard, yeah.
And it's skinny like kid Tom Hardy, not like buff Bane Tom Hardy. Yeah. So anyway.
I mean, it would have been better if he was just playing Bane. Like obviously it would have been impossible for when that movie was made. But they should remake it.
What movie would not be better, Sean?
This is a very good point. On guard.
Imagine if Batman v Superman, the villain were Bane. That would be such a better movie.
Yeah, it definitely would. If Bane was manipulating Batman and Superman to fight each other, for sure. I'd buy it.
And then Bane kills Batman because he's like, man, I'm Bane. I'm not a good dude, but you're a mass murderer, dude, so.
Like, I'm not a good guy, Batman, but holy shit, dude. You're doing some fucked up shit. Like, I can't even abide this. Like, I mean, I would love Superman, but at least he saves people, you know?
That's my Bane.
Okay, now I'm imagining a really good version of Batman v Superman.
Yeah.
Or at least a better one. Anyway, so I saw that. I remember, like, when we had those years when we had Netflix on DVD, just that was a lot of what we got was Star Trek discs. And, boy, those were quaint different times.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. Back when you watched TV shows, when there was, like, 3 episodes on a DVD.
Yep.
Yeah, it looked terrible.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was that. And then somewhere in high school, they started re-releasing Star Trek The Original Series Remastered. They did the... Yeah. Mostly what was important, actually, was going back to the 35mm film, making it look nice and clean and clear, but also they did the CGI Enterprise stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember, to my great shame, so this would have been 2006, so right before, it would have been middle school, actually, like last year middle school, I had an HD DVD player for my Xbox One.
Okay, I vaguely remember that you having one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when they first released the remaster of Star Trek The Original Series, it was on HD DVD. So this would be a couple years before when they came out on Netflix.
Right.
And so my dad got me that HD DVD set of Star Trek, and that's how I actually saw the first season for the first time.
Okay.
And I've actually never watched any Star Trek series all the way through. Like, there's no show where I've seen every episode, and it's not the kind of show where you need to have done
that.
Yeah,
obviously it's... it's more like Doctor Who in the sense of that every episode stands on its own. It's not like Breaking Bad or something.
No, and with Star Trek, the original series, I think you need to see season one because it's as good a season of TV as exists.
Yeah.
Season two has a ton of great stuff. I would put it slightly below for me.
Yeah, me too.
But it's great. And then I've seen very little of season three just because it's not very good.
Yeah,
but
I've seen all of season three, but I don't remember much of it these days.
And then Next Generation, I've just hopped around and I have my favorite episodes, but I kind of like with that show that I can still discover new episodes because I haven't seen everything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, like, basically I've seen it. The Next Generation in the same format of like hopping around and hearing about an episode and watching it and stuff like that, and generally enjoying it. And the one time I like was like, okay, when I was back into my phase of like I'm going to like watch through whole TV shows when I was in high school and like early in college when I had that much time to do that, it's like I'm just going to do Next Generation this time. And then I started watching Next Generation.
Well,
it's like season one of Star Trek: The Next Generation is a fucking thing, dude. Holy shit, that show was bad. That show was really bad.
Wesley in that first season.
Everything. I mean, well, not everything. Like, a lot of the actors that are good, like Patrick Stewart, are still good, but, like, the episodes are just fucking bad.
There's a couple of good ones, and other than that, they're mostly bad.
Shit. I think I got, like, 7 or 8 episodes in, like, of, like, just, like, watching them in order. I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this, dude.
No, it's...
Holy shit.
And season two isn't much better, although it's got episodes like Measure of a Man and things like that right, that are very good. I remember season one of Next Generation, when I tried to watch it all the way through, has the episode where Wesley, they go to this planet where you're not allowed to walk on the grass, and that's punishable by death, and Wesley does it, and I was so mad at Captain Picard, because he's breaking the fucking Prime Directive to save fucking Wesley!
They break the Prime Directive every single episode of that fucking show. It drives me crazy. It's like, it's called the Prime Directive, you assholes. Like, if you can't figure out how to write an episode with your own show's lore, just change the lore at some point.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Wesley sucks.
Yeah, no, yeah. The Prime Directive just fucking sucks, too.
Yeah.
Get rid of it.
Anyway.
We're humans. Just take over, like, fucking colonialism. Just take over the universe. Star Trek is
ridiculous,
optimistic bullshit dream.
I just remembered something.
Okay, yeah.
When I actually started watching Next Generation, we didn't even start with the DVDs. We had several VHS tapes.
Jesus.
Of episodes. We had The Best of Both Worlds on VHS tape.
Okay.
Still my favorite Star Trek thing ever. I will go to the mat for that. And then... All Good Things, the finale, had on VHS tape, and a couple other stray episodes, and then the DVDs became more widely available, like on Netflix and stuff, and we started watching them that way.
Yeah.
But I have seen Star Trek on VHS. I forgot about that.
Yeah, watching TV shows on VHS tapes,
that was a trip.
Yeah.
They did, I think, get out every episode of Next Generation on tape, but it was usually like one a tape.
Yeah, so you had to like rent out like a storage garage somewhere to keep them all, because. Then you're not pulling all those, because that's like one or two episodes per tape. Like, that's not feasible.
Nope. So, anyway, that was fun. But yeah, no, the original series, I mean, that definitely took my interest in Star Trek to another level, because as good as The Next Generation is, and there's a ton of great stuff in The Next Generation, I wouldn't take anything away from it, that first season, particularly, of the original series, is some of the best sci-fi storytelling ever. It just is.
It's just such a good show.
You've got
across the board
the main three characters, but also the supporting ones. I don't want to ignore people like Sulu and Uhura, who are
they're good. Like, they're obviously, they don't feature in like the episodes as much. Like, especially if you've only really seen the original cast in the movies, you probably would think that they are like way more prominent characters than they actually are.
Yeah,
but they are like important in some episodes for sure.
Right,
they are members of the cast.
Mm-hmm. Scotty being my favorite of all those people, side people.
Actually, I really love Sulu.
I love Sulu.
Like, some of the episodes where Sulu gets more heavily featured, he kind of goes crazy. Like, because there's like, every episode of Star Trek, the original series, got done like 2 or 3 times over the course of that show's airing. So it's like, I feel like there are like 2 or 3 episodes where Sulu goes crazy, takes off his shirt, and like fences and fights people.
Yes.
Like, it happens at least twice.
Sulu's great. I mean, George Takei is just wonderful.
Yeah.
Scotty's wonderful. Chekhov actually doesn't come in until the second season, but I like him when he comes on. So all of that's good. But that first season, like, just pound for pound, episode for episode, it's all really good. And there are obvious standouts, like City on the Edge of Forever. Yeah, that's one of the all-time great TV episodes. But the Corbomite Maneuver. Love that one. The Balance of Terror with the Romulans, which is sort of their first big almost like space naval battle thing.
Yeah.
That's fantastic, and you really cannot overstate how great that holy trinity is of Kirk and Spock and McCoy, and how much each of those has their each of those characters has their own personality, how well they play together, how competent they seem as a team of professionals.
Yeah, and that just thematically, the way they work for the show, like, it's just something that is just so genius for a show like that, where they are three characters that they feel very, like, alive, and they feel complex and, like, well-rounded as characters, but at the same time, they just, like, sort of symbolically represent very strong individual standpoints that makes it so that each writer that comes to the show to write, like, one episode of the show can take these characters and knows immediately what to do with them and write them well. And that's one of the things that I think works so well in the original series' benefit in the way that a lot of later Star Trek shows, and a lot of shows in Star Trek's mold, can kind of fall apart, where you get some bad episodes in, like, The Next Generation and stuff like that, where it just feels like some of the characters don't quite feel like the characters because the writer of that episode doesn't understand how to write for Worf or Picard or whoever, you know. Whereas for the original series, especially for season 1 and season 2, it felt like every writer who came to that show knew exactly how to use Kirk, knew exactly how to use McCoy, knew exactly how to use Spock and their relationship together, because it's just a strong archetypal relationship.
Absolutely, and they could do so many different things. Like, yeah. You can have episodes as different as, I'm forgetting what it's called. It's a Shore Leave.
And
it's
that's a great one.
It's a great one.
I love that episode.
And it's got these Alice in Wonderland themes and things about dreams. And I think on the surface it looks cheesy and all this stuff. But it is so much more than that. And it is absolutely a lot of fun. But it's also just a really good sci-fi story.
Yeah. And it's just such a great premise. Like, there's just a planet that, like, is basically a theme park planet that takes, like, your subconscious and makes it reality for fun. But if you don't know that that's what's going on, it's going to freak you the fuck out.
Absolutely. And then there's episodes like the Something in the Dark one, where you have the moment is pain, but you have that monster. And everyone remembers that the monster looks stupid. What you don't remember is it doesn't matter because the story being told is phenomenal.
Yeah, and it's about, like, it's a silicon-based life form on this mining planet, everything. Yeah, it's a great episode, too.
No, I mean, there are very few shows like Star Trek that are completely episodic. There's no continuity between episodes that I can just sit down and marathon. Yeah. I can do that with Star Trek, the original series.
Yeah, and I think it really has a lot to do with those characters. Like, they are just, like, I just can't emphasize enough how much, like, they made me able to get into Star Trek and become a real fan, because they are just so unbelievably perfect.
Absolutely. I want to defend William Shatner for a moment.
Okay, yeah.
Kirk is the best captain. There's no...
Yes.
And part of that is, and I will say, you know, I think Patrick Stewart is the best actor who ever worked on Star Trek.
Sure.
That's just clearly in his career. And I love Picard, and it tells you how good a character Picard is and how heavily Next Generation has to lean on him sometimes.
Yeah.
Because they really, even though Next Generation technically has a deeper bench of characters, they couldn't utilize them in the way they could sort of their leads on original series. So there's a lot of the great episodes of Next Generation are sort of just Picard solo stories.
Yeah.
Like The Inner Light or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Or the one where Q takes Picard back to when he had the heart transplant, and Picard has to, like, remember his past and, like,
change.
I'm not
sure if I've seen that
one. It's called Tapestry, is what it's called. It's phenomenal. That's another one that's sort of just a Picard solo story,
right,
and things like that. So, but with the original series, these characters were so deep, and Kirk is one that I think people remember as a ham because William Shatner is, to the larger world, a ham.
Yeah.
But on Star Trek, he's much more than that.
Yeah, and like, it's like context is important, where it's like a lot of the acting on Star Trek can feel very hammy, because, I mean, and it is from a certain perspective, but, like, I think, like, that's part of the whole aesthetic of the show. It has something to do with, like, the time and place of when it was made. And I think, like, the acting, I mean, like, the acting from with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy is, like, kind of over the top, but it needs to be. Because, guess what? The special effects were not there. That's no fucking secret. Everyone on this cast, it, like, knew that the special effects were not really there the way they were with, like, Star Wars and the movies and stuff. When you're, like, looking at that, and when you're looking at what's going on in, like, cinema with a much larger budget, Star Trek looks very quaint even for its day. But if you have a bit of over-the-top acting and, like, the actors are really into it, that sells the effects. It's what made old Doctor Who work. It's what, like, and one of the reasons why I love old Doctor Who is that the acting is fantastic, because it is hard to be really over-the-top and cheesy and but still be a strong, believable character that is charismatic. Like, it is really hard to do that. And the actors who are able to do that are insanely talented. And that's what the cast of the original series were asked to do every single time. The actors have to sell the special effects more than the people actually making the special effects.
Absolutely. And what William Shatner was so good at is he could project this intense sense of intelligence. Like, he was calculating, he knew what he was doing, he's the captain you want to go into battle with because he's probably going to win. Because he knows what he's doing at every moment, he is experienced. It's actually one of the big, and I think interesting dynamic differences between the way the old show treats Kirk and the reboot series with Chris Pine treats Kirk is one of the conscious decisions they made is, all right, we're going to have a younger Kirk.
Yeah.
But Kirk in the original series, he's had a career. He's been on ships. He's been someone's first officer. He rose through the ranks, and he has his first command. And that's where we pick up with him. And you feel that sense of experience with him, I think, at all times.
Yeah.
And so William Shatner, I think, is just really good on that show. And especially sometimes in the movies when he gets a chance to do really big things, like in Wrath of Khan or The Undiscovered Country, or just be funny in things like The Voyage Home. He's very good at all that.
Yeah.
But he's also kind of the linchpin of the show because he's balancing, if you look at the trifecta, it's a fairly simple thing, but it's well done archetypally, where you have Kirk is like in the middle, and you have Spock being pure logic, McCoy being sort of pure emotion, and Kirk is the one who kind of brings them together. And William Shatner's very good at that.
Yes, absolutely. He's,
And Leonard...
It's easy to, like, make fun of him, but...
Yes.
I mean, there's a reason why that character and William Shatner, by virtue of that William Shatner himself as an actor, are so iconic in popular culture, like, around the world.
Yes. Yeah. So, and then Leonard Nimoy, we've talked about him so many times, especially, I mean, you know, recently passed away. His work is just beyond reproach. Like, I don't think any, and that's the thing, we say a lot of it's exaggerated. Leonard Nimoy's work is absolutely exaggerated, but no one can perceives it that way, because it is just so, it's such a weirdly naturalistic performance of a strange alien.
It just feels so flawless. Like, it's just like, you don't think of it as an actor playing a role. Like, and Leonard Nimoy was definitely one of those actors who was able to just, like, disappear into a role where, like, even though he's a very iconic guy and he has such a unique look, like, I feel like whenever you see him in anything, you go for a second like, oh, hey, it's the Spock guy, but then you immediately forget about that, you know?
Yes, he just disappeared into Spock. He's so good. His chemistry with everyone on that show, but particularly Kirk and McCoy, is flawless. And then, of course, McCoy himself. And
he's such a, I feel like, is an undersung member of that show these days, because people, like, because he doesn't have the iconic presence of Kirk in Spock, because he is the most understated of those characters by far. And then also, like, the new movies, even though they have an unbelievable McCoy in Carl Urban, have not made use of him the way that they need to, you know?
Yeah. No, absolutely. And McCoy, when you go back and watch it, you realize it's not the Kirk and the Spock show.
No.
It's the Kirk, Spock, and McCoy show.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny, because even in the original titles, I think they had... Okay, William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy, and then later they added DeForest Kelly, because I think you realize you have to have DeForest Kelly in there.
Yeah.
He's McCoy, and in the early episodes he doesn't figure in as much, but you do see how quickly they course correct and make him an integral part. And he's great. He's so funny.
He's unbelievably funny.
He's so full of life. He's kind of in some ways just the heart and soul of that whole thing.
Yeah, I mean, because that is his role as a character. He is the empathetic one. He is the heart of the Enterprise, because he's the doctor, you know?
And he has, you know, he and Spock are not static. They change and they evolve, and that's actually kind of
one of... And they grow closer to one another, archetypally.
So one of the interesting things about Kirk definitely evolves, but it's in a much more kind of understated human way, whereas I feel like McCoy and Spock kind of get the arcs, quote-unquote, in how they change and develop as people. So, Those characters,
The original series is so good.
All right, we mentioned some favorite episodes. What are some other ones?
Like, it's been so long since I watched it. I mean, obviously, Space Seed is the first, one. That one's
classic
for a reason. The triple one, everyone knows that. It's a good episode.
It's great.
It's so much fun.
I think people want to hate Tribbles because everyone loves Tribbles. Tribbles is really good.
Yeah. Every episode that has some form of Kirk or Spock or someone being evil and it being like an alternate dimension or a teleporter malfunction. That's another one where I feel like that show did that plot 3 or 4 times.
Oh, of course.
Even just in season one.
What's the one? Is it... There's a bunch of good ones. Is it The Enemy Within? Where is there your first evil Kirk? Yes, it is. And it's a really early episode. That's the one that ends with like, I want to be, or I want to live.
Yeah.
I want to live. I love that. That's a really good scene. Yeah. So that's a good one.
Any original series Star Trek episode that features as part of its core plot, Kirk having to teach an alien woman the concept of love, that's just a gimme. That's already good. You've already nailed it.
Arena. I don't even know if I have to say more.
Is that the Ponfar one?
That's the one with the what, the Gorn.
Oh, okay, with the Gorn. That's a fucking great one.
I love Arena. It's so good.
The Ponfar one is also very good. I don't
The Ponfar one's good. Devil in the Dark is the one I was thinking of earlier. City on the Edge of Forever needs no introduction. Yeah. And there's a bunch of other good ones. They're all the Harry Mudd episodes that were shouldn't have been as good as they were, but those are actually pretty good.
Yeah.
I like those ones. There's like the ones where they go back in time and things like that. Yeah. Like there are multiple ones where they go to planets that are like 30s Chicago.
Where like some like American U.S. history book from a starship like got onto a planet, so they base their entire culture around like mafia stuff. There's a similar one that has that with like Nazis instead.
Yeah,
that was good.
Yeah, there's just I'm looking through the list of episodes. A personal favorite for me also is The Menagerie, which is the two-parter that utilizes the original pilot, and the framing story is Spock is basically trying to defend Captain Pike, who was the previous commander of the Enterprise. And that's just a very emotionally charged episode that's very... makes use of that original pilot, which is great on its own, and that's the one that only had Leonard Nimoy and everyone else was different, and utilizes it very well, so...
Yeah, that's such like a smart move of like you have all this footage, let's just use it.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. There's the is Taste of Armageddon the one where the society like the people fight computer simulated
war games one? So like the people who have been decided have been killed by the war like projections and stuff have to like go into the incinerators or whatever.
And that's one of those episodes that feels as relevant now as it did then, I think.
Yeah. I mean it's more relevant now because that episode is about the way in which modern technology is changing the face of war, and it turns out we have just continued along that vector, like that with like drone warfare and stuff like that is way more relevant now than even when it came out.
Star Trek's a hugely prescient series in so many ways, and you know, we should also talk about, I think one of the central themes of the show that I love is its optimism, and I think that's something modern Star Trek sometimes gets and sometimes it doesn't. But it is a fundamentally optimistic show, and I don't think it's a dumb optimistic show.
No. Yeah.
I think
Star Trek does fall into that territory later sometimes.
Yes.
It just being like, sort of almost like falls on its face with how it's like misreading reality in some ways. It's like overly optimistic.
But I do think Gene Roddenberry's point, and I think this is the implicit point of the show, is either we get to this point and we get along in this way, or we don't get to that point at all.
Yeah.
Or there is no humanity in this time, you know? And I think that's kind of one of the points of the show is that this is what humanity needs to be or humanity will cease to exist. And I think it's something I've been thinking about a lot recently with how awful the world is at the moment, is that, yes, that's if you were ever to get to the point where humanity could set up successful space travel like this, we're never going to.
Yeah, but we're already past the point of no return. Like, that's not happening. We're going to be extinct in life.
But it is a fairly beautiful vision of the future, and I think it's a smart vision of the future, and it's an interesting one. And I think, you know, different movies treat it differently, but and different seasons and episodes treat it differently. But when it's right and it's well configured, I like that part of the vision very much.
Yeah, and I think it was best done in the original series where it feels understated. And that's one of the things where, like, I was making fun of the Prime Directive thing with Next Generation. Obviously, like, the Prime Directive and stuff like that is an element of the original series. It feels like, as Star Trek went on, like, it started leaning into that stuff really hard, where I think there's something about... partially, there's a place and time thing with the original series where when it came out, it was in the 60s. It was in the middle of the civil rights movement. And Star Trek is very famous for a lot of different reasons with that. It has an incredibly diverse cast. It has Lieutenant Uhura, a black woman, who is like fourth or fifth in chain of command to like take over the Enterprise. Like, she's like a prominent character on the show that is given like an important, capable role. She's not the maid on the Enterprise. Like, she is the communications officer. She's on the fucking bridge. She's one of the most important people on that whole ship. And it also has like the first interracial kiss on television that like broadcast studios did not want to show, even if it was like, when you go back to that episode now, it's like a total creepy like rapey kiss because it was like mind control shit, but like that's how you had to do it for the first time, you know? And there's an element of that, of like the quiet optimism of the original series of Star Trek in the face of this great period of change in America's history, that is where I think that optimism works really well, is that it's just saying, you know, fuck all this shit that's happening right now. This is what we need the world to be, and this is what it can be. And it's just very quietly, without trying to make, like, Like, it's not throwing that stuff in your face all the time. It's not trying to make that statement. It just is that statement completely effortlessly. It just has Uhura on the bridge. It just has Sulu on the bridge. And that's just totally fine, you know?
Yes. And I agree, it kind of waxes and wanes in other periods of the show's history. One other one I wanted to mention, just because I always go back to this moment when thinking about the philosophy of Star Trek.
Right.
It's a great moment in the movie First Contact. Which actually deals with this a lot, because it's a time travel film where they go back to humanity's first contact with the Vulcans.
Yeah.
And so in that movie, as people forget, Picard taught women how to love a lot also.
he's not the aplomb that Kirk.
No, but he was often like just paired up with different alien women also, even if this one was a human woman, but from the 21st century.
Yeah.
Anyway, but in First Contact, he's with one of these human women, and he's on the bridge of the Enterprise, and she's trying to figure out, how do we do this? Like, as people, how do we do this? And she says, how much would this have cost? And Picard says, we actually got rid of the concept of money a long time ago. And we realize, Picard gives this whole speech that I think is partially as beautiful as it is because it's Patrick Stewart and he's a Shakespearean actor doing it. But it's a really nice moment of trying to, I think, summarize the philosophy of Star Trek, which is the idea of, if human endeavors were to be done on this scale, it's about people doing it for the sake of doing it and for the sake of progress rather than for the sake of money or other petty considerations. And it is interesting because I think that is very key to Gene Roddenberry's vision, who would have passed on at that point, of essentially a socialist future and a future that is and not socialist, communist. And I don't mean communist in the way of the Russians. I mean it in kind of the original Marxist, like utopian society vision of people living and working in communities and things like that. So, you know, and I think about that today sometimes where things feel particularly dark, but at the same time, progress does, maybe on a micro level, maybe on a macro level, it does win out. We don't go backwards. Things can feel very dark because people resist change and things like that. But ultimately, you know, we are at a period in history where people in the United States, for instance, have many more rights than they did when Star Trek began.
Yeah.
If we want to give a time period to that. So, you know, it is a vision of progress as being part of the human condition, and I like that kind of optimism because it's an observant optimism. It's not an ignorant optimism.
Although, for me, like, that is some of the stuff where, like, I really think it's a beautiful sentiment, but at the same time, there's something about the way that society has changed that it feels like Star Trek misread, I don't want to go super Marxist here, but it misread capitalism. Like, it misread how that works. It misread how the human society adapts in the ways that it does not adapt. And like, there's something about that that, like, it feels like sad in a weird way. I'm just like, oh, like, that's not...
No, and
Star Trek, I guess one of the reasons why I like Star Trek, the original series, so much is that it feels like it doesn't lean on that stuff. Like, it is still a part of the setting in the background, but, like, I guess there's something that feels very timeless about the original series because it doesn't lean on that in the way that, like, a lot of, like, Next Generation stuff sometimes feels like, this is a show that's pre-9/11. Like, this is a show that is pre the world we live in and does not feel like it's actually reading the way things are going.
Yeah, I mean, Next Generation is made in the peaceful 90s. It's it's a very different thing. I mean, I'm very interested actually to see how Brian Fuller will handle this on the new Star Trek series when given time to do it, because, you know, I think J.J. Abrams' own 9 movie does it right, where it's just the world is the world. And that's the optimism in it, is just the world is the world. And then I think my least favorite thing about Star Trek Into Darkness, and it's why Roberto Orci and Alex Kurtzman were the wrong people to be writing this, is it's got this giant conspiracy theory thing to it, where the whole plot of that movie is that Starfleet is infiltrated by bad people, and not even infiltrated, but people are corrupt, and they decide to... It's basically a 9/11 truther narrative.
Yeah.
And it feels like it was made in 2005, even though it was made in 2013. And that is very fundamentally not Star Trek and the vision of that show. So, you know, you can get it right and you can get it wrong. And it's tough, though, in a post-9/11 world to even think about it.
Yeah.
So, but Star Trek, it's really cool.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I love it to death. Like,
my
love is focused around the original series and that cast and in some of those movies. But it extends to all Star Trek in different ways. I really like Worf, for example.
Worf's
really cool.
Worf is great. And I love that, you know, I really have never watched much of Deep Space Nine or Voyager.
Yeah, I've only seen, like, piecemeal episodes here and there.
But I love that there are people who love those, too. I like that it's a broad enough show that it has different pockets of fans in different areas.
Yeah.
And I like that it is and has been a fundamentally positive thing for the world in terms of bringing people together and having, you know, friendships and things like this. And the convention scene was sort of invented by Star Trek. I mean, you go back to the day there wasn't that kind of thing before Star Trek and kind of the comic book revolution of that period and stuff. So all of that is very positive as well.
Yeah.
All right. I want to go through the movies really quick because the movies are up and down.
Yes, very famously so.
Yes. Okay, so for this, I meant at some point to do this as a bigger project, and I would do something like watch some of these again, and there's one I've never seen all the way through, and maybe go through that so I could do a more accurate ranking. Ultimately, did not have time to do a lot of that.
You were just watching too much Dragon Ball Z to be distracted by it.
Really, that's the case. That being said, I have seen most of these movies. Oh, I've seen all of them except one, and I've seen them all multiple times. So I do...
Okay.
I feel like I'm pretty sure in my rankings, especially because number one is clear enough that it makes the list easy to do.
I know what movie I would pick as number one.
Yeah. And then I have some other choices that are probably unconventional in here, and there's one movie I love that a lot of people don't, and we'll talk about that. But
Does this list include the J.J. Abrams ones, or is it just
yes.
the original? Okay.
Because to me, they're Star Trek movies.
Sure, yeah.
And why not?
I feel like there's an argument to include them and not include them. I was just curious.
I agree. But also because my problems with Into Darkness notwithstanding, they are better than most of the Star Trek movies.
Absolutely.
So I feel like I have to include them. Anyway, number 12. There have been 12 movies so far. Beyond is the 13th. So we're doing the original 12, or the first 12. Number 12 is Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
Okay.
This is the one I can't watch. I can't get through it. It's the one that starts with them going camping in Yellowstone.
Yeah.
It's the one where they chase God or something like that. It's got Spock's brother or something. I don't know.
I think I've only seen the beginning with the camping scene is the only part that I remember.
It's very bad. William Shatner directed this one. He didn't know how to direct, famously. He directed because he was jealous of Leonard Nimoy directing the previous ones and directing them very well.
Yeah.
So it didn't work. Oh well. And I should say it's not all on William Shatner. The studio was losing a lot of faith in Star Trek at this point, which is weird because The Voyage Home was by far the biggest hit, the fourth movie. And so they didn't have time to finish the effects and things like that. So this one is famously bad. And I think, I bet I would get, if I watch it all, if I force myself to watch it, I think I might enjoy it more than some of the bad Next Generation movies, but the difference is I love these characters more, and that makes it harder to watch a bad one.
A bad original series movie stings in a way that a bad teen, because especially because you have Star Trek II with the original series, and you don't have a Star Trek II with the TNG cast. There are some decent TNG movies,
This is the only really bad original series movie. Like the other ones, there are some middling ones. But there are also a bunch of great ones, and none of them are bad. I think some of them are just less good. But the other five I really like. So Star Trek V is at the bottom.
Okay.
Then we've got a bunch of Next Generation movies. Number 11 is Star Trek Insurrection, which is number...
This is the other big problem I have with the Next Generation movies. I can never fucking remember which one is which, so I don't know if I've seen this one or not based on the title. It sounds like a Star Trek video game to me.
No, it does. This is movie 9. This is the one... that has, if you break it down, like the dumbest plot of any Star Trek movie. Because what it is so there's this planet where everyone's peaceful, and there's some kind of force around the planet that makes them youthful and like they feel good there.
Okay.
And so they go to this planet, and Picard falls in love with a woman there, as he always does, because Picard is a womanizer. He's just not as flashy as Kirk.
Yeah.
And like, I think Geordi gets to take off his visor, and he gets to use his real eyes, although... At this point, Geordi doesn't have the visor, so I guess he just takes his eye implants out, something like that, but he gets to see the sunrise with his real eyes because there's a healing power on the planet. And on that planet, they don't use technology as a big thing, and so they have to... The Starfleet is studying...
Yeah, in like a billion other planets in the history of Star Trek shows.
Right. But I was going to... So Starfleet is studying them, but they don't want to like, you know, insert themselves into it, Prime Directive and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But I love all the bullshit talk in this movie about how they don't use technology, and they're a very technologically advanced society. They just don't use electricity. But they have, like, it's this weird thing that people don't know anymore. The word technology does not mean electricity.
Yeah, it doesn't mean, like, it doesn't mean electric machinery. Like, a lever is technology. A spoon is technology. Tools are technology.
All the things that Nathan Drake runs into in Uncharted, that's technology.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. The great, grand, like, gear, the works of the ancient civilizations that, like, make giant statues turn and shoot photon beams to, like, activate traps. Yeah, that's more advanced than us technology.
I'm pointing this out because one of the whole themes of the movie is how these people are so pure and great because they don't use technology, except they do. So there's all these like thematic muddled elements in this movie. And so anyway, there's so much dumb stuff like this race of aliens who, like, their skin is peeling off, want to take over this society so they can heal their skin or something like that. It's really dumb. And anyway, someone in Starfleet wants to let them do it, and so Picard and friends decide to go against Starfleet to save the people on the planet. And basically, it's like a big episode of Next Generation, but a really bad one. Like a really super boring one with like a low budget.
So like a season one episode of Next Generation.
It pretty much is.
Actually, it's, what exactly that sounds
it's,
like.
It's like, it's so dumb. It's got like the way, I like Data, but there were moments where they used Data very poorly in that series. Yeah. And this is one of them. Because like the opening of the movie is Data goes crazy and Picard has to sing him Sondheim or something to get him back and calm him down, and then later when they decide to go against Starfleet, Data says something like, lock and load, motherfuckers. I don't think he says motherfuckers, but he says something like that.
Yeah.
And it's really stupid. Anyway, this movie is boring more than anything else, but also if you want to engage with the plot, it's just mind-numbingly dumb.
Okay.
It is the worst Next Generation movie.
What is it called again?
Insurrection.
Okay. Try to remember that.
Number 10, Star Trek Generations.
Right, yes, so this is the bridge one.
Movie 7, yeah. This is the one where you have Kirk in it, and you have, I think Scotty appears and stuff like that, but mainly it's Kirk.
Yeah.
But this is the one where you jump to the Next Generation crew. And there is some good stuff in this one, but this is another one that's a really dumb plot. It's about the Nexus, which is this like area where you go into your mind and you're really happy, and there's this villain, and I forget his name, and he wants to get into the Nexus, and so he's blowing shit up and trying to get them in there. And Kirk wound up being... He died, but then he's found... You turn out he's in the Nexus, and then at one point Picard gets sent to the Nexus, and he finds Kirk there, and Kirk is like living on a ranch with horses and stuff, and then Kirk comes back with Picard to save the day, and Kirk dies falling off a bridge.
Yeah, and it's... I remember Malcolm McDowell plays the villain.
Yes, he does.
And he is a great actor who has picked some very bad roles here and there over the years. This may be one of the worst like uses of Malcolm McDowell.
Oh, absolutely.
Again, like, love Malcolm McDowell to the death. He has picked some fucking awful shit to be in.
Yeah.
This is probably the worst role I've ever seen him in the movie I personally watched.
Yeah, and this is one... This
big
is...
waste of Kirk as well. They just don't...
Oh, totally.
They just don't... It's such a great idea to have Kirk and Picard meet, and
they did nothing with
it. Yeah, they fucked it. Just everything about it up completely and entirely.
Oh, absolutely. They ride horses for a little bit, and then Kirk falls off a bridge and dies.
Yeah.
And it's super shitty. And I mean, they've basically, I think in later series and stuff, just nixed this in the canon and done other stuff with Kirk's death, like in books or something.
Right. Yeah.
I would not
be surprised if that was the case.
Yeah, I'm not big on all of that, but that's to my knowledge they've done some of that. So
yeah.
Generations has some nice moments, but it's also like, it really feels like a couple episodes of the show stitched together, like with all the stuff happening on the ship, where like, there's a whole subplot with Geordi gets his eyes and Data gets the emotions chip and all of that, and it's not good.
Yeah. And like, and the worst part of it all is that it does like have this huge wasted potential to it. That's like, that definitely for me would sink it in the rankings.
And this is one of the many Star Trek movies, by the way, where they destroy the Enterprise.
Yeah, it's an ongoing theme for the films at some point.
Yes. Anyway,
is 3 the first time they do that?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Then it's just sort of,
because in 1 and 2 they have a new Enterprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. Okay, so number 9 is Star Trek Nemesis. That is the 10th movie.
Yeah.
We just talked about it. Nemesis is okay. It's not bad. It's not good. It's okay. It's got some really cool stuff. Like, I think some of the action is good. I think Tom Hardy is a good villain in this. I kind of like the idea of Picard having a clone in this whole thing. They're basically trying to do Wrath of Khan without doing Wrath of Khan. Like, in some ways, it's more creative than Star Trek Into Darkness, which was just doing Wrath of Khan.
Yeah. Only, like, you switch how Kirk and Spock are at the end, as if that's supposed to be meaningful in some way.
Yeah. So, stuff like that. So, there's some decent stuff with that. There's also some stuff where I'm not sure if they knew what they were trying to do with it, where they meet Data's second brother, because they forgot about Lore, but they meet B4, who is Data's other brother, and Data dies.
Named that guy.
And then B4 becomes the new Data. And it's weird because this movie, you know, this was the last of the Next Generation movies, last time we saw any of these characters on screen, and there is some good stuff in it of, like, wrapping things up. You know, like Riker and Deanna Troi get married at the beginning, things like that.
Okay.
And if you look on the DVD, there's actually some deleted scenes that kind of would have made it feel more like a final movie. And like the alternate ending of this movie is really good, and I have to knock the movie down a peg for not using it. Like, it's a much better like ending to the series because okay. It's something where Kirk is like, or not Kirk,
Picard
gets a mission, and someone asks, like, his new first officer says, "Oh, where's that?" And Picard says, "It's somewhere no one's ever gone before." And they go off, and like that's a good like last note to leave the series off on. And I don't think the movie has that at the end. So, oh well, but it's okay. I would recommend it if you're interested in Star Trek movies and you haven't seen this one.
Or you're very fond of the color green, as far as my
memory it's goes. Very green. This is the second best Next Generation movie.
Okay, yeah.
It's not very good. So, let's move on. Number 8, got Star Trek 3 here, The Search for Spock.
Okay, yeah.
Not a great Star Trek movie, but I really like it.
Yeah, I have basically the exact same sentiment. Like, it's hard for me to sit there and call it like a really amazing movie or anything like that, but it's a very entertaining one.
I mean, you got Christopher Lloyd as a Klingon.
Yeah, that's already amazing. Like, the ending of this movie is so fucking cool. Kirk and fucking Christopher Lloyd Klingon, like, fist fighting on a lava, like, destroyed planet. It's basically the Frieza fight in Dragon Ball Z, only if fucking Frieza blew up the Enterprise also.
Yes, and the Enterprise gets blown up, and actually they blow it up themselves as, like, a decoy to the Klingons. Yeah. So there's that whole thing. I mean, there's the stuff at the beginning where they have to escape Starfleet so they can go save Spock. And it is kind of interesting having a movie largely without Leonard Nimoy, although he's behind the camera, and kind of what is the team without Spock. I like that side of things.
I like the beginning where McCoy is crazy because he has Spock's ghost inside of him.
Yes.
That's a really great idea.
So yeah, this movie has a lot of great stuff and some stupid stuff. There's the whole thing where Spock is rapidly aging his body and he has to mate with Savick.
Oh, right.
Who is played by a different actress this time. Mm-hmm. It's very strange.
Yeah. But it's a fun movie. It's worth watching if you like that cast. Like, it's a good use of that cast.
I mean, it's an interesting thing because basically in Star Trek 2, obviously, they write themselves into a corner. And I think this is probably as well as they could have done in writing themselves out of that corner.
Yeah.
So, I like it.
I like it too.
Number 7 is Star Trek First Contact, the 8th movie. This is the only TNG movie people tend to like.
Yeah, I think I saw this on TV is my main memory of it.
It's pretty good. It is essentially a sequel to the Best of Both Worlds episode,
right,
which is a better Star Trek movie than any of the TNG movies.
Yeah.
Basically, where the Borg come back, they're going to invade Earth in the past. So they go into the past, and then the Enterprise chases them into the past, and the Borg are basically going to try to stop humanity's first contact with the Vulcans. And so it's just got a very direct plot. It's got a lot of focus. The other TNG movies just have no sense of focus. They basically feel like big episodes of the show.
Yeah.
This does not. This is a movie. It's got some good action. It's got some good acting. I like Picard's whole... Basically, he becomes Captain Ahab against the Borg, and that's fun and stuff.
Yeah.
And so there's some good stuff. You got James Cromwell as the guy who first discovers space flight in this world. Not space flight, but faster than light travel,
I should say.
So the warp speed, basically. So that's all good. I like it.
Okay.
I don't know if I have more to say than it.
I remember almost nothing about it other than the premise.
It's a perfectly acceptable Star Trek movie.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. Number 6, Star Trek Into Darkness.
Okay.
Worst title of any Star Trek movie.
Yeah, we have set our piece on this title.
And I think it's got a lot of problems, and I don't want to deny that, but I did watch it again recently on Blu-ray. I actually got to... The Blu-ray has the IMAX version of the movie, which actually adds a lot to the movie, because it's kind of like The Dark Knight or something, where they shot some scenes in IMAX, and just... I love the visual style of J.J. Abrams' Star Trek movies, so this one kind of has more of that, with the IMAX stuff is really cool, and a lot of the visuals and the action sequences are great. The movie has a bad plot, and I don't think there's any denying that. The story is aggressively stupid, and the stuff with Khan is aggressively stupid. And it was, from the moment they decided, all right, we're going to have Khan as the villain, but we're going to pretend he's not Khan.
Yeah, the whole fucking marketing bullshit. That's like J.J. Abrams taking his whole like mystery box thing to its like absolute limit with my patience.
But it just made no sense also in the movie, because the big reveal is he says, "My name is Khan." And it means something to the audience. It means nothing to the characters.
And honestly, it only means something to a portion of the audience.
Yes.
Like, especially assuming everyone watching the Star Trek 2, J.J. Abrams version, knows Star Trek 2, the original, is a huge miscalculation.
Yeah, especially because he doesn't bear much resemblance to Khan.
Yeah.
Ricardo
in a lot of different ways.
Ricardo Montalban and Benedict Cumberbatch are two talented and very different actors.
And neither of them are Indian.
No.
But they're both not Indian in different ways.
Yes. Although the British guy playing an Indian name is probably more offensive.
Considering that Britain took over India and like oppressed it for decades and decades, yes, I would say so.
That's my point.
Yeah.
Anyway, all of that stuff is stupid. At the same time, as a movie, this one has an energy,
yeah,
it has a
fun
momentum, it has the great special effects, the great music, the
great cast from the first one.
Great cast, and frankly, that elevates it above at least all the movies I just listed.
Yeah, because like, it is something where it's like, I definitely, upon first viewing, I liked Star Trek Into Darkness more than you did then, and I haven't seen it since, and my opinion hasn't changed. Of like, it's not amazing, but it's fun, and especially now that we have gone through the bottom of this list, you are absolutely right, it is a lot better than those movies.
Yeah, and you know, I liked it a lot the first time I saw it with reservations. I liked it less the second time, and then I hadn't seen it for a while, and then I saw it on Blu-ray, and I liked it. I just, it's fun. It's got the cast. I wish, you know, they had gone in a different direction for the sequel. I think the big mistake was the end of Star Trek 09. They've set up the 5-year mission and all that.
Yeah.
Okay, just do it. And instead they decide to do another Earth-based story for this one, and it's very strange to me.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of, the other thing, and this is why I'm excited for Star Trek Beyond, which was written by actual Star Trek fans,
yeah,
is there's a lot of stuff in Into Darkness where if you want to get nitpicky, they don't know what they're talking about. And I don't mean like little nerdy stuff like, warp speed doesn't work that way. I mean,
yeah, yeah,
just fundamental things. Like, in the first scene, there's this whole thing where Spock is like, Spock is detonating a bomb to save this society, which is a direct breaking of the Prime Directive.
Yeah.
And he's saying to Kirk, don't save me, that would be breaking the Prime Directive.
Right,
you
yeah
don't know what the Prime Directive is.
To be fair, historically, I think the majority of times the Prime Directive has been invoked in Star Trek, they didn't really understand the Prime Directive.
That one just particularly irks me a little bit.
No,
as
it's
like
bad. Yeah,
it makes
sure
no sense. Yeah,
yeah,
there's stuff like that. So anyway, and this is also one where, God, what's his name? Peter Weller is in this.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah. Robocop.
He is awful in this movie, but in a hilarious way.
Yeah.
And there's some other, like, bad line readings where, like, there's just bad lines in the script. One of the lines my brother and I always quote to each other is when Kirk comes up to Khan, he's like, you are a criminal! And it's really funny, because Chris, what is Chris Pine supposed to do with that line?
Yeah, and then also, like, it feels like a bit hypocritical coming from this version of Kirk, who's, like, a punk piece of shit, who's, like, destroyed God knows how much property, like, in, like, millions. I mean, they don't use dollars, but
yeah,
there's some value associated with you destroying all the shit you've destroyed in your life, Kirk.
It also bothers me that this is a Star Trek movie that ends with a giant ship basically decimating San Francisco and no one talks about it.
Yeah.
Like, that would be the worst thing to happen to the planet Earth ever.
Yeah, but I mean, to keep in mind, this is Star Trek. Like, we are off planet Earth. We have colonies on other
okay
worlds. Like, it's okay. If a couple of million... Put it in perspective, if we are measuring our population in terms of trillions, millions of people dying, that's fucking nothing. Who gives a shit? That's a tiny amount of people.
That should not be the calculus in Star Trek.
Yeah,
is all
that's
I'm saying.
That's the world we fucking live in now Star Trek, Jonathan.
All right.
I want to state for the record, while I don't have any problem with you organizing them this way, I would personally put Star Trek 3 above Star Trek Into Darkness as the two movies we have talked about so far that I have watched and remember. Personally, I'd put Star Trek 3 above Into Darkness, but not
really. I was trying to spread out the original series movies as much as I could.
Okay,
even
yeah
though really they're kind of the top five, and then
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
No. Anyway, no, I understand. Number 5, Star Trek 4, The Voyage Home.
Yes.
They save the whales.
Yes.
It's fun.
It's very fun.
We hear about the nuclear vessels.
Yep.
This is not a deep movie. This is a totally surface level movie, but it is on the surface so much fun and just so fast-paced and good-natured and makes such good use of that cast. It feels like just a celebration of Star Trek.
Yeah, it's just a fun time to spend with those characters.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like a very good episode of the original series in the vein of Shore Leave or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So
one of the more goofy ones.
Yeah.
Sure.
And at the time, it was, and I think up until the 09 movie, by far the highest grossing Star Trek. It was a huge phenomenon.
Yeah.
Relative to, you know, what movies earned at that time. So it's very good. Directed by the great Leonard Nimoy.
Yes.
Who, you know, kind of put himself in the history books with this one in terms of directing something that high-grossing at the time. So that was kind of cool. Number 4, I got Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country.
Okay, yeah.
I think this movie's underrated, not because people dislike it, but because people don't talk about it enough. It's okay, really good.
I don't remember that much about it.
Okay. Honestly. The story... So this was the last one with the original series.
Yeah.
And it came out, like, midway through the run of The Next Generation. So we already knew, because The Next Generation obviously is set, like, a generation after Kirk and everyone. And yeah. So we know that even though in the original series the Klingons were enemies, by the time of The Next Generation, Klingons are our friends.
Right.
The Undiscovered Country is about basically how peace came about between the Klingons and the humans.
Yeah.
And it's a really good story. It's got a lot of good character interactions. You've got this whole section where Kirk and McCoy are like stranded on this planet together, and that's kind of fun. You've got Spock sort of thinking about his role in the world again, now that they're all kind of, they're ready to retire, basically. And I like seeing, you know, Kirk has to overcome his hatred of the Klingons because they killed his son. Namely, Christopher Lloyd killed his son.
Right, yeah.
Is it blackface if a white guy is a Klingon?
If we're going to get into talking about, like, Klingons racially, like, that's a huge discussion to have.
Just a weird thing, because I just thought about that. Like, Christopher Lloyd, he's Klingon. We really now only have black people play Klingons for clear reasons, yeah. I guess. But yeah, anyway, it's a weird thing.
But is having black people play Klingons, is that in and of itself racist, is the question I'm thinking of.
That's probably a good question, too.
Yeah, so like, I don't think we're not equipped to answer that question.
You know what, I'm not even thinking about it. Christopher Plummer is the main Klingon in this movie. He's white.
So there you go.
They did this a lot, apparently. Okay, never mind. Anyway, but yeah, so you got all that. I do think Worf is actually in this movie, like makes a cameo, like he's a young ambassador or something.
Yeah,
that's kind of fun. Right. But no, The Undiscovered Country, very good. It was directed by Nicholas Meyer, who did The Wrath of Khan, and I think it is of similar quality.
Yeah.
So it's really good. And the ending is fantastic, where basically Kirk, who is an admiral now, he has to return the ship because it's not his anymore, and they decide to go on one last just like trip around the solar system together. Yeah. And I think his last line is, Sulu asks him, you know, what's our vector or something? And he says, second star to the right, straight on till morning. And they leave. And then like the signatures of all the main cast members appear. And that's it. And yeah. It's like, that to me makes Generations, the next one, seem extra unnecessary because you should never see Kirk again after that.
Yeah.
It's the perfect ending for his character.
Yeah.
And for everyone. So... Really,
I really need to rewatch this one because it's been, I haven't seen it since high school.
Yeah, and I did not have time to rewatch it. It may have gone higher or lower, probably higher, but I like it. So yeah. I've seen it a couple times, so it's very good. Number three for me is Star Trek 09, the J.J. Abrams movie. It's really damn good. And
I don't like this movie. I like this movie, but I don't like it nearly as much as most people do.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It's something that's always bugged me about, like, the way people talk about it, that it's like, everyone just assumes that it's culturally understood that it's a really good movie. I'm like, it's okay.
Okay.
It's just okay.
I really like it. I love the cast. I love the story that's told. I think it's a very creative way to kind of set a blank slate so they can tell new stories in this universe, which is, again, why Into Darkness was pretty confusing, because they didn't make use of that afterwards. I think it moves very well. I think it's really well paced. I love the way they use Leonard Nimoy in this. I think it's very creative. And I think the entire new cast does great work. And I think this one makes much better use of, you know, Carl Urban, for instance, than the second one does, where he's kind of barely in it.
Yeah.
I like Chris Pine's arc as Kirk, and a Kirk who is on a different path. And so we can recognize him as Kirk, but I like that he's a different person, even though, you know, like the experiences have changed him, and you see that same kind of sense of aggression and brashness become something else. I think that's very creative. You know, I have talked about this movie so many times. I think people know I like it. I think I saw this movie 5 times in the theaters or something. Not necessarily on purpose, like it was something where sometimes I would go to the theater and intending to see something else and it'd be sold out or something and I wound up just seeing Star Trek again. But I saw it a lot and I've had it on Blu-ray and I really enjoy it. I love the cinematography. I am a fan of J.J. Abrams' lens flares. Everyone else be damned. So... I think, and especially for the time, like it just felt like such a kind of creative breath of fresh air for this kind of sci-fi movie to be made with this kind of enthusiasm and this kind of verve to it. To me, it was recognizably Star Trek and also recognizably something very, very different. And that's what it needed to be. And I liked that about it. So, and I just think as a movie, as a 3-act story with characters and action and momentum, I think it is better than the vast majority of Star Trek movies.
I mean, yeah, because that's not setting a very high bar. I think my main issue with it was always, I think a lot of the plot with the villain and all that stuff just, like, I found really boring. And I only ever watched it once in the theater. I've never gone back to it since. And again, like, I'm not saying it's a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination, because the cast, we've talked a bunch on this podcast about how good the cast is. But I think there's just something about the style of the movie and the plot and the just the villain and all that stuff that just, it does not feel Star Trek to me. And there are moments that feel very Star Trek across the movie, mostly doing with the cast, but there's just, like, inescapably every now and then, like, I remember when watching that movie, it just pulled me out of it and just felt like, this just feels wrong. And I was like, my main takeaway of this is, like, there are sequences of, like, when they're trying to be funny, like, the way they tackled humor, I found really abrasive, I remember. And just, like, it too action-y, like, I've never really liked the lens flare thing that much. That, all that stuff, but...
It's been 7 years. You might want to give it another chance.
Yeah, sure. I mean, or I could watch a new movie. Or I could rewatch another movie I know I like.
Okay, that's fine.
Or I could rewatch Star Trek VI, which I remember liking. But don't remember much about.
All right.
Instead of Star Trek 09, which I remember thinking was okay, but not that great. Better than Star Trek Into Darkness. But.
All right, I'm about to deliver an unpopular opinion. My number two Star Trek movie is Star Trek The Motion Picture.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really agree with that, but I don't care that much.
Okay. I will explain my case. I think I've talked about this a lot.
Yeah, we've definitely talked about this on the podcast before.
I love this movie, and it's funny because I've seen it 3 or 4 times, and the first time I saw it, I remember... It's on DVD, and at this point I knew enough about the legacy of Star Trek of, like, this is one people don't like. And it famously cost so much, and it was not a bomb by any means, it just cost so much. It was the most expensive movie ever made at the time, I believe. So, maybe accepting something like Cleopatra or something like that, but it was definitely, for that, like, era of film, it was way up there in terms of cost. So it wasn't a bomb, but it kind of was tepidly received, it was different than what people wanted. So it had that kind of legacy behind it, and I sat down to watch it, and I'm like, I really like this movie. I find it emotionally engaging. I like how it uses the characters. I like that for their first attempt to do a movie based on this thing, based on this TV show, they went in a different direction. They did something you could not possibly do on the show. They did something with the characters that you could not possibly do on the show. I liked all of that so much. And I didn't see it again for a couple of years, and I kind of went back to thinking, well, maybe I was just wrong, and it's not that good. And I watched it again. Like, I still really like this. And it was the same the third time I saw it. And so it remains a movie I very, very much like. I think, and I almost don't even think of it as a Star Trek movie at some point. I think it's just almost like there's some very avant-garde elements to it. There's some very experimental stuff in how they treat visuals and visual effects and things like that. I think this was a Douglas Trumbull movie in terms of special effects, or he worked on it with some other people. So, he did things like 2001 and very famous effects artist. I think the effects in this movie are absolutely gorgeous, like when they're going through the nebula and when you see the Enterprise for the first time. And I think for people who dislike it, they famously remember the scenes of the characters staring off into space at the effects and not liking those sequences. To me, that's what the movie is about, and if you don't like it, I get that. But the entire movie is about the wonder of space travel. And it's about wonder as a concept, and I don't mean that in the simple sense of people just in, like, oh, that looks cool. It's about this kind of, it's about ecstasy, and it's about the sublime, and it's about these as real, deep concepts, and that's something I became more aware of with this movie the more I studied those concepts in film school and how those relate to film and to the art of filmmaking, those sorts of things. And I think this movie is actually very aware of those ideas, and I think it has a very interesting view of Gene Roddenberry's vision of what Star Trek is, which is its very cerebral. It's not action-oriented. It's character-oriented. You have some very interesting character arcs here where you have Spock at the beginning of the movie trying to completely purge himself of emotions. And by the end, just by virtue of being on this ship with these people and having seen what they see, he again comes to understand, no, I have to have these emotions with me. And it's actually kind of funny because this movie does a bunch of stuff that Star Trek II also does. And Star Trek II is almost a remake of this in some ways in how it treats certain character arcs. And I think people forget that I do think some of what makes Star Trek II good is that they tried to do what Star Trek the Motion Picture did in a different way with a much more propulsive story. So all that being said, I do like this movie. I wrote an essay about this the last time I saw it, like 3 years ago, that I never published. Maybe I'll do that this week and finally just put it out and people can see some of my thoughts on that. I'd have to rewrite some parts of it, but I really like this movie.
Yeah, I've only ever seen it once and I don't remember hating it. Like, I just remember feeling like it was a watered-down 2001 A Space Odyssey. Like it's stylistically, it felt very similar to that movie. But, like, 2001 A Space Odyssey, like, is treading such a thin line between being, like, one of the best movies ever made and, like, the most boring movie ever envisioned in the history of the art form. It's, like, it is fucking on that line like a motherfucker. And to me, like, Star Trek couldn't toe that, or Star Trek The Motion Picture couldn't quite toe that line.
And that is not in any way an unfair criticism. Yeah. That's a fair criticism of the movie. I totally get that. On the other hand, to me, blockbusters don't do this kind of thing. And it's so fascinating to me to
like
see
it's,
this.
It's an interesting movie.
Yeah.
That, to me, that's not the same thing as saying it's a good movie. It's like not a movie that I feel like compelled to watch again.
Okay, and that's fine. I like it.
Okay.
So we'll move on. My number one, Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, duh.
Yeah, that's... Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan is a really fun movie. If you've been listening to this podcast, you probably know that by now.
We've done an entire episode on this thing. Yeah. It's fantastic. It's just... It's note perfect. It's one of those stories that it's like it's a 2-hour movie or something, but it feels like it's 5 minutes long sometimes because it is so well paced and well put together, and the story is so direct, and it's got such a good character tie and emotional tie and thematic tie in with everything that goes on in it. And of course, Khan is a great villain.
Yeah.
And I love it does one of my other favorite sides of Star Trek, which is the sort of naval warfare in space sort of idea. I mean, and really why these two are always my number two and one is Motion Picture completely to me represents the cerebral side of Star Trek, and Wrath of Khan is the naval and the adventure side of Star Trek done perfectly. And so that's why I love these two so much. But Wrath of Khan is beyond reproach.
I think it's the right way to handle a Star Trek movie in some ways. It's just not to try to just mimic what... Like, it's not to do a Star Trek episode, necessarily. It's like, that idea can work, and some movies feel a bit like that and are still okay. But I think, leave, like, the very, like, you know, social commentary, sci-fi plots, leave that for the TV show. The TV show format is very equipped to tell those kinds of stories in a way the movies are not necessarily. And have the movies be about the characters, have the movies have... action in them. Don't let it, like, Star Trek 2 is certainly not dominated by the action the way that the J.J. Abrams movies feel to me sometimes, but the action's an important part of it, and having this very dynamic villain and this competition between Khan and Kirk, it's just a very strong piece of filmmaking, and it's not trying to replicate what the TV show did, it's trying to do what the TV show couldn't in its format, and using this very strong setting and very powerful cast of characters to do that.
I mean, how many other movies can you name like this where the villain and the hero are never physically in the same space, and yet they have this dynamic relationship?
Yeah, they have, like, more chemistry than most protagonist-antagonist relationships in other movies.
They never acted opposite each other. I mean, Ricardo Montalban filmed his scenes after everyone else was done, if I'm not mistaken. It's crazy.
Yeah. And man, fucking Ricardo Montalban in that movie.
It's good.
Man, it really is one of the best villain performances of any of those kinds of, like, genre movies, you know?
Absolutely. All right. Well, that's the Star Trek movies. We talked about the show. Anything else we want to say?
Star Trek's good. If you have not watched the original series, give it a try. Like, if you have been, felt, like, pushed away because it seems dated and stuff like that, really get, like, try and watch it and get, like, if you are maybe not engrossed by one episode, give it a couple of episodes. Well, God damn it, that show's so good.
Well, I will say this. If you are someone who has been resistant to it in the past, I would not start at the beginning and just try to marathon it.
Sure.
I would watch episodes we recommended, go online, look for someone's top 10 list. I think a lot of people have the same kind of top 10, 20 with these.
Yeah.
Because the first couple episodes of the original series are a little tough to get into because they, like, McCoy's not in the first one.
Yeah.
The second one is, I think, one of the Harry Mudd ones. They're just... I think you can go back as a Star Trek fan and enjoy those, but if you're trying to get into it, you know, watch the Corbomite Maneuver or Devil in the Dark or something like that.
Arena.
That's just as a, yeah, or Arena is a great one to start with. Yeah. Just a really good Star Trek story and kind of get your fix and get to know the characters, and then you can go back and see how they experimented with things.
Yeah, because it really is, like, it's a fantastic show. It started the Star Trek franchise, and that franchise has endured for a reason, and I think, like, if you go back to the original series, which I don't think a lot of people in our generation are. I feel like when I've tried to talk to people about it, a lot of people are big fans of, like, The Next Generation and maybe some of the movies they've seen, but, like, they feel hesitant to go back to the originals, and I get that, and I get why it feels dated and it's hard to get into, but really, man, that show is so good, and it doesn't get the credit it deserves from people our age, I think.
Absolutely. Yeah. All right, well, we will be back next week. We will talk about Star Trek Beyond.
Yes.
We will talk... More so, though, our big topic next week, I'm so excited to do this episode, Might need to be a two podcast week. We'll figure it out.
Yeah.
Is Jason Bourne, the fourth Jason Bourne movie coming out at the end of the month. And we are going to, before that movie comes out, do a retrospective on the original three movies, which I rewatched last year and was so blown away by how much they held up and were even better now to me, like knowing more about film, how much I loved them. And I think I'm so excited for this next movie because it's Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon coming back. And we've never gotten to talk about these movies on the podcast because obviously when the last one came out, we were still several years from starting this thing.
Yeah.
So are you excited to watch and talk about those?
I'm super excited. I got my Blu-ray set in a couple of days ago. If you are someone who has not seen these movies or hasn't seen them in a long time, there is a very cheap, easy to get Blu-ray set with the first three movies on it.
Yep.
Because I have not seen these movies in a long time. Like, I've rewatched Identity and Supremacy a little bit more recently, but I saw Ultimatum in the theater and I haven't seen it since.
Okay.
So it's been a long
time. 9 years. Yeah.
I am super excited to get into it.
They're great. All right, so we'll see you next week.
Yep. Jason fucking Bourne, man.